What's up, everybody? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 162. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, as always, Jonathan Lindemann.
I do it for the people.
James Jones. And Greg Leahy.
It's good to be back, isn't it?
It is good. You know, one time, just once, the rest of us should record at like 3 a.m. and...
I think
and
you said this like a year ago, and we're no closer to it happening.
Well, it's stuck in his craw ever since.
I once recorded an episode of Radio Trivia around noon. I think that's going to have to be it for me. That's my lot.
Well. We have a big show for you today. We've been playing a lot of games during our little time off, and so we'll be getting those in a minute. And, of course, after that, we have... actually, we're going to do a news roundup, since the newscast is kind of... in limbo, or we're not anticipating a new episode of it imminently. So we're going to try to do a little bit of news catch up, and then after that, we have your listener mail, as always. And of course, before we start, I do want to say that, you know, I kind of hinted at the end of the last episode that we were maybe trying to do something big for Retroactive, and that's why there wasn't a poll up. And if you watch the website, Nintendo World Report, you hopefully have already seen that we are going to be talking about Geist next. This is the GameCube game that someone had written in about a few weeks ago, kind of wanted to give it a shout-out. And it got me thinking that I kind of happened to know a dude who was a producer for that game. So I mentioned it to him, and his name is Jeff Callis. He used to work at Nintendo of America, and he was a associate producer for that game for Nintendo. And so he's going to be on the show next week. Cross your fingers if everything goes well. He's going to be on the show, and we're going to get to talk to him about Geist, which will be really cool. It'll be kind of an interview, kind of a discussion, and kind of Retroactive. We're still going to pick up the game and play through it. I've never played it before, beyond a couple of E3 demos. So I'm excited to try it out, actually, especially having gone back and looked at what it's all about. It's like, wow, this does sound really cool. Like, I'm very excited to go back. But, of course, this being Retroactive, we hope all of you listening will also dig out your copy of Geist or go pick up a cheap one and play through it as well, and leave some comments in the forum thread, which you can find at the website pretty easily. And then also, if you get it in within a couple of days after this podcast goes out, if you can be pretty quick on the draw, you can even put in some questions, and we'll be happy to pass some of those along to Jeff. So it's kind of a really cool opportunity. It's a little bit something different. And then after that, we will definitely go back and do a poll for the next Retroactive, just like we have been for all the others. So I hope everybody's going to be okay with that. I hope you're excited like I am. Okay, well, on to new business. John, I know you're not playing a ton of games these days, but... you do have like a new review copy or something, like an actual Wii game?
An actual Wii game, yes. It's rare. I got a review copy of Dirt 2, and it's pretty mediocre.
this is the racing game, right?
Yeah, it's a racing game. I didn't play the original Dirt on 360 or PS3 or anything like that. So this is actually my first introduction to the series. I mean, it's obviously a rally racing game. I guess this is kind of like a shoot-off of, like, Colin McRae's...
Grid. Yeah, I think it's at least like a cousin of Grid. I don't know if it's a descendant exactly, but it's related, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
like...
Grid came out of the Colin McRae stuff, you're right.
Yep. And so this one, I guess, is kind of the more extreme version, where it's set in, you know, kind of more exotic locales. And... the thing is, it kind of tries to be like a action racer, but it controls like more like something like Gran Turismo. So if you can picture, I don't know how many of you guys have played Gran Turismo, but a game's kind of stiff to control. Like it doesn't try to, like, you know, be some kind of like, you know, Excite Truck kind of experience. So if you can picture that and going over ramps all the time, it's pretty brutal to play a lot of the times, because either you're going over flat land and you're completely in control, or you launch off a ramp and you just completely lose it. And on top of that, it's the tracks. There aren't really that many tracks that I can see. It's pretty mundane. I mean, like, for example, you don't have music playing while you're racing, which normally it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But it's just kind of like it almost feels like you're playing like a DS game where all you hear is the drone of the engine.
I'm trying to think. if there's been any kind of good like simulation racer for Wii, and I would not be the expert on that just because I really don't like simulation racers, but I mean, there's a market for them. There are fans of that, and I don't really think there are any good ones. There aren't very many, period, on Wii, but there definitely aren't very many good ones.
Yeah, I mean, there's other issues too. I mean, in general, like when like the races, it's you against three other cars, and probably the best thing about the game is the actual car models are pretty cool. You know, they're fairly detailed and they're big. But the problem is when you're going through the larger parts, when it tries to draw far out, you know, it starts to chug, especially in the corners. And then when you have all four cars like stuffed into one corner trying to get around, it just starts to chug on you, which really kind of takes you out of the immersion, I guess you could say. It's not a terrible racer, but it's just kind of mundane. There's just not a whole lot going on. They, you know, a lot of the tracks, they repeat, they're reversed, you know. And the thing is, it seems like it's just kind of stuck between wanting to be this sort of over-the-top kind of action racing game, but then it's also kind of beholden to this simulator kind of experience that they're trying to give. And it's just really weird. And also, I was playing. It's much better to play with the nunchuck and Wii remote as opposed to the Mario Kart style, you know, motion controls. Because the motion controls, I mean, the controls are floaty. They're floaty as it stands. But when you're sitting there trying to play with the motion controls, it's laughable. I mean, I was having a blast playing it because I was actually laughing at how bad I was doing with the motion controls. So if that tells you anything, I mean, my wife was sitting there watching me, and I'm just like, this is just terrible.
Not for the self-conscious.
Well, I believe the games get a lot better from here.
I'm sure they do.
Starting with Greg, who you're enjoying your new PS3, right?
Yeah, well, I did have it operational 2 weeks ago when we recorded, but I hadn't really played very much. In fact, a fair amount of the time I spent playing Earthworm Jim 2, which I did speak about in the last episode, was spent during the updating and installing of 9 files for Little Big Planet. Has got a lot. And I thought, well, it has been out for a while, so that's understandable. And then I came to play it 2 days later, and there was another one.
Yeah.
I was impressed with that. But yeah, so I hadn't played it a great deal at that point, but I've kind of settled down with my PS3 now. The game I've been playing by far the most of is not some nice title, say, from, oh, I don't know, 2007 that I might have picked up on the cheap, but it's from, me being me, 1997 with Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which is one of the biggest sort of holes in my gaming experience that I had left to fill, really, because I'd never played it.
It's your personal Chrono Trigger for me.
I guess you could argue that. For me, it's a bit different from the point of view that specifically I love Castlevania, and I've played most of the other Castlevania games, especially now having played Castlevania 3 and Rondo of Blood quite recently. And I also love Metroid, so you know, this is the original sort of synthesis between Metroid and Castlevania, so this was a huge deal for me playing this for the first time. And so I went right into it. I just beat it today, actually, the sort of the quote-unquote good ending, as has become the convention with the Igarashi Castlevania games, where you have the sort of bad ending at halfway and then the good ending or whatever. So it was what I expected. Obviously, I know a great deal about the game, and I mean, the DS games really do take from it wholesale.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but, you know, Symphony of the Night has been very influential on a lot of other games as well, including, like, you know, Spider-Man Web of Shadows on DS, which you just were finishing.
Yeah, much like Johnny, my appetite for that particular gameplay style is sufficient to actually sustain playing two games at pretty much the same time. They're very similar.
Yeah, of course we all know that, you know, Metroid and more so Super Metroid were the real creators of this gameplay style, but I think the RPG elements that Symphony of Night adds are pretty significant. And also, I think with Castlevania, I think what Igarashi did with that game, it was so mind-blowing at the time, because what he said was, you know what, Super Metroid is this great game. At the time, it had not been out for that long. It was only like 3 years old.
3 years, yeah.
And Super Metroid at that time was not nearly as beloved and respected as it is now. And so what he did was he said, you know what, there's this great awesome Super Nintendo game, and there should be more stuff like that. So rather than just wait for them to make another one, which would have been a bad idea, I'm going to make my own version of that and merge it with all of this other stuff from this completely different Castlevania franchise. And the merging of these two franchises into the so-called Metroidvania thing was kind of a revelation. And that really opened the door for all these other people to say, you know what, maybe we could make a Metroid-style game. Because no one else had ever really attempted it before then, except Nintendo. So I think, you know, Symphony of the Night is kind of a groundbreaker in that sense, even though it is in some ways derivative of Super Metroid.
Certainly. You know, and Igarashi speaks about it proudly, as TYP has recounted a number of times at things like GDC, about how, you know, they recycle things, they recycle assets in particular. Mm-hmm. In fact, Symphony of the Night isn't really the beginning of that. It's actually a lot of it's sub-recycled from Dracula X, because Dracula X is actually sort of the prequel, or this is the direct sequel to that game, so a lot of the sprites are similar. But so I was quite interested to see how different it was from the newer ones, in terms of the newer ones, the production values are lower, being as they are handheld games and things. And it really does have a lot of the same shortcomings as the new games in particular. I think the biggest shortcoming I have with all the Metroidvania-type games is that the map design is one thing, how everything's laid out and connects together, but the actual level design for the rooms that make up the map are another thing. And too often in those Castlevania games, compared to something like Super Metroid, they are the corridors with enemies, and that's it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's very present in Order of Ecclesia as well, and it was equally present at the beginning, you know, before they'd done the formula to death. It's not so much that they've gotten lazy over time with that; they just that's the way it's always been. I can see now, and still, I find that a little disappointing, because, you know, the funny thing is, you know, if I was gonna hold up an example of sort of really good 2D level design, you know, something like Dracula X, which this game is a sequel to, is a great example, and yet it kind of lacks that particular part. That's probably where it's weakest, is sort of synthesizing the two, is getting some of that sort of classic kind of platformer design into it.
Greg, don't you think the RPG elements are a lot more pronounced in Symphony than they are in the follow-ups?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of changed it around a bit. You know, they had this kind of, you know, almost like Pokemon-y thing going on with collecting the souls and stuff like that in later games. You know, it was a little bit different. It wasn't so equipment-based, and just wacky inventory things like, okay, so you assign a potion to your hand, and then you actually have to use that in the middle of battle rather than just go to the menu and press, you know, sort of... I mean, it definitely seemed more RPG-like.
Have you messed around with the shield rod very much?
I haven't used it, no.
Yeah, you can do some pretty ridiculous stuff once you get the better shields.
Yeah, I understand you can. I mean, I tried to play it sort of fairly sort of down the line. I mean, there's a lot of cool powers that you could turn into the bat and the mist and all that.
Yeah, I love those.
They're not that necessarily that well balanced, though. I mean, the mist is really exploitable in the boss battles. The rate at which it depletes the magic meter isn't really sufficient to sort of dissuade you from using it very consistently if you wanted to, which can make some of the boss battles a little easier. Although I guess that may be somewhat dependent on what level you're at, which for me, because I just kind of wanted to explore everything, I ended up leveling up pretty high.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really go to like the end of the first castle until I was at 90-odd%, and then the end of the inverted castle at 190%. Mm-hmm. In general, it is wonderful. I mean, the soundtrack is so good. I've heard a lot of it outside of the game, but there's so much of it.
Well, it was a CD game, and that was...
Yeah, but I mean, you still have to write it and everything, and it's so varied. You know, I mean, that's my favourite kind of Castlevania soundtrack, is the ones that are most varied, like Castlevania 4, which is quite different from Symphony of the Night, but in itself is very varied, whereas Dracula X is kind of more consistent. I mean, the variety is pretty astounding, you know, when you consider, like, from the harpsichord to the electric guitar stuff. It's a pretty broad
range.
Well,
I mean, what's interesting is, over time, I think that series, music has kind of come to the forefront as being one of the hallmarks of that series. I mean, now it's, you know, you have all these, like, aren't there, like, remix albums and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, but actually kind of goes back before that, though. Yeah. I mean, in Japan, you had, like, weird rock CDs of Castlevania stuff, like, from the 16-bit days. I mean,
yeah.
I think the people took the Castlevania music to their hearts quite a lot, and that may well have influenced why so much effort went into the music of Symphony of the Night, that they had something to live up to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went really big with it, and you know, with the CD sort of format, and did a fantastic job. It's definitely a big part of what makes it much more fun to explore stuff and find new areas and stuff. It's just especially the impact that would have made in 97.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen stories online about, you know, how many versions there are of Vampire Killer.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the thing. See, Vampire Killer does not feature in Symphony of the Night unless you are talking about the Saturn version, which is apparently there's not much to commend about.
Yeah. Pretty terrible.
Because, of course, this is from PSN. This is the original version with the awful voice acting.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I was fully prepared for how bad it was going to be.
Oh, God.
It is quite legendarily bad, but I was still quite taken aback. Good God.
Yeah, it's like, you must go back to hell. It's just terrible. Like,
and also
so
the
wooden.
Thoroughly inappropriate ending music as well. It sounds like it would be the end to a sort of 80s romantic movie or something. I really don't know where that came from.
So that's a PS1 game that you've been playing on your PS3, but you've also been playing a PS3 game?
Yeah, I have. So Little Big Planet, as I sort of referenced earlier with the updating stuff, is what I've probably played most out of the retail games that I've got. And it's probably of all the HD console games, you know, that was one of the ones I wanted the most to have. So, you know, kind of all went in the PS3's favour when the price cut started happening, and because it just seems very much like my kind of game. And I mean, for what I've played of it so far, I certainly haven't played through all of the sort of single player campaign, which in itself is not really that much of a huge slice of what you can get out of the game. But I mean, it's so imaginative and it's so charming, and it has the kind of that everything's kind of fabricated kind of aesthetic that mm-hmm. you've seen in Yoshi's Story and Dynamite Heady to an extent and stuff. But you know, because it's polygonal and because it's HD and everything, it comes across so much more vibrantly than it ever could in those cases, because mm-hmm. you know, the textures are so good and so mm-hmm. detailed, and you just get a sense of, you know, where things kind of look like a kind of pop-up diorama and all the different kind of materials and all that. It's really got this playgroundy kind of toy box thing going on. But in terms of the gameplay, I mean, I've heard a lot of people talk about the jumping mechanics, you know, that some people don't like them or whatever. And I mean, I think you're almost getting into the bit of the, you know, going back to what we talked about with Super Ghouls and Ghosts a bit, and not that the mechanics themselves are like Super Ghouls and Ghosts, but they are different from, you know, your typical kind of Mario style platformer. And I think sometimes that just, you know, people find that kind of difficult to adapt to or something, because there really isn't anything wrong with them, for my money.
No.
They're just different.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I really ever had a problem with was it can be a pain sometimes to go between the three different planes. Like, because it can be hard to figure out exactly where you have to be, because what they'll do is you'll be running along a platform that's maybe on the middle plane, and then you'll quickly have to jump onto something swinging in the background that's actually on the back plane. And it's kind of weird trying to get over to it sometimes. It can get kind of...
Yeah, sometimes, like, with the camera angle and stuff, it's not always mm-hmm. totally obvious what's going on with that.
I played the demo of this on my new PS3, and I really like it, too. I'm definitely going to pick it up once I can get a good deal on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it weird that at one point in the demo, it's kind of a tutorial and an advertisement, really, more than a slice of the real game. But at one point, it tells you that if you're jumping, the next platform is in the background, you'll automatically shift into the background. But if it's in the foreground, you have to actually push down and do it manually.
Yeah, there's definitely some automatic switching going on, but I've never really been... I was not all that clear on exactly what the conditions were for that.
I thought it felt strange, because sometimes it does it for you and sometimes you have to do it.
Yep.
It seems to work in general, but it's a little idiosyncratic, definitely.
There must be some rules about it, because people are making their own levels. So, I mean, there must be some consistency there, but it's just not... It's not super obvious the first time you play it what's going on with
it. I mean, I think them adding it, I think it's worthwhile, just because it extends the kind of like the depth of the puzzles that they can kind of put in there.
Yeah, definitely. And a big part of it is very collecting leverage game. You know, again, a bit like Yoshi's Story. Well, it's vastly more interesting than that. The way they kind of tie it together with the whole user-generated angle is that you're collecting the materials to build levels. So it's kind of encouraging you to find all this stuff, as well as it creates a score for you for each level based on how much stuff you collect. So it just makes the sort of foraging part more interesting when you've got those three depths to kind of explore. Mm-hmm. In certain cases, you really do have to figure it out exactly how you would get to a certain thing. You know, they'll do the classic side-scrolling platformer thing of kind of teasing you with something that you can see, and you wonder how you're going to get there. And, you know, it could be quite a sort of circuitous route that you'll eventually have to take, and you'll get there eventually. So it is all the levels that I've played that are by Media Molecule are pretty interesting, occasionally quite challenging, you know, and they have this sort of flexible checkpoint system, which means sometimes you can basically die more times without having to restart the level. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of clever. You know, sometimes they can change up how difficult a particular section will be without it being sort of really annoying.
Yeah, I also like how there's some parts where you can get extra stuff if you play with two players, which I thought was really
cool. Yes, that's a good point.
And you can play online as well.
So you've got online co-op, and it's very explicitly labeled, like certain items you'll see, and it's like a sort of physical puzzle to get to it, but it's got the little Sackboy times two. I mean, it will be interesting in terms of relative to New Super Mario Brothers how they will handle stuff like that. Like, will they have things that you can only get in co-op? And if they do, will they label it? Will it be obvious, or will you have to discover that for yourself, or will it just be an alternate way of doing it with one person?
Knowing Nintendo, I have a feeling that the approach they'll take with New Super Mario Bros. Wii is that there will be a lot of things that are easier to get if you have
Easier, but there's an alternative,
Right, if you're playing alone, there's some crazy, you know, slide under bricks and pop up and...
The cheese bridge trick from Super Mario World, you know.
Exactly. There'll be some, like, really high level, you know, very technical way to get up there. I mean, you know, like in the original Super Mario Bros., how you can bounce off walls and things like that, ricochet. You know, you can slide under low-hanging bricks and stuff like that. I mean, there's always been stuff like that in the Mario games. And, you know, there's stuff in even like Mario 64, there's a lot of places you can get to with wall jumps that if you do it that way, it's actually really time-saving for some of the races and stuff. So I think there will probably be multiple ways, and some of them are just more difficult than others. That seems like the Nintendo way to handle it.
Just to sort of finish up a Little Big Planet, I've played just a tiny sampling of user-generated levels for online. But even in that time, I've been very impressed with what you get. I mean, in terms of, you could see it's really going to enhance the experience, and some very creative stuff. Like, what one of the things I played was like a sadistic comedy level that was called The Unfair Platformer, where the whole point was you had infinite restarts, but it just kept killing you. It was just kept killing you in amusing ways. Like, the level begins with something that's basically like, you know, the bits in the Bowser's Castle, the Super Mario Brothers, where you kind of have to, where there's like a correct path through three different little sort of channels. It's like
terrible.
That, but instead of it just looping, if you get it wrong, you die if you get it wrong. you just get squashed like straight away or whatever. But the great thing is you finally get through it correctly, and then what happens is you go to jump over this pit that's immediately after it, and a wall just appears in midair, and you go dunk and die straight. So you think you've done. And there's other great stuff, like there's the levels end with a big monitor which displays the score, and you get to a monitor and then you just get squashed, and it just says, you thought it was over? And it's the kind of thing that I wouldn't say you'd never get from a developer designed level, but you probably wouldn't. You know, and it is funny.
Yeah, very tongue-in-cheek, definitely.
But there's some more high-order stuff. Like, I was playing something today where you've got different coloured blocks that have different gravity associated with them. So if you're jumping from a certain kind of block, you can barely get off the ground with a jump, whereas if you're jumping off others, you can leap very high, and all this sort of crazy platforming based on that. And I thought, wow, I mean, this is, you know, completely different from anything I've played in the regular game. Mm-hmm. And just very well thought out, very clever stuff, and just great stuff like that. And then, of course, there's what I thought would be inevitable Mario homage in there, but it was fantastic, the one I played, Super Mario PS3.
Yeah, there are some like, that are absolutely fantastic.
All this stuff they created, like, you know, these assets that just perfectly replicate stuff from Mario. And then there was like a Mario Kart sequence in the middle of the level. You just went up onto Rainbow Road and rode around in the kart for a while and then came back and then went into a sort of Bowser's Castle thing. And it was just, I mean, it's, the care and attention is impressive in itself, but just the fact that it could do this, you know, that there is the scope to create stuff like this. And you could even, like, it has the sort of prizes within the level, so now I actually have objects from that level that I could use in my own levels from playing it. So, I mean, the value there, I mean, for what I got it for about £10.
I haven't seen any deal that good. I'm still looking for one.
Well, I mean, Johnny, you might want to think about getting the Game of the Year edition.
The Game of the Year edition is $60.
Well, I'm just saying, if you can find it cheaper, it's probably worthwhile because they pack in a ton of user-generated levels in there, and you get a lot of costumes and stuff like that. So,
and they're still adding to the game because they're going to add water, apparently, which is not in the game at all originally, but they're going to add water into so that people be able to make levels where you could swim around or be in a boat or all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, value-wise, it's pretty great. I mean, it's ridiculous for what I got it for, but I mean, I'm sure you could, if you paid full price for the Game of the Year edition, you would be disappointed because it's quite remarkable.
Right. Okay. Real quick before we move on, Greg, what you been watching on Blu-ray?
Oh, I see. I've got 2001: A Space Odyssey.
That's on my Christmas list.
Yeah, that's wonderful in HD. It looks incredible for a film from the 60s.
Oh, it always has. It's the most beautiful film ever made, I think.
I got Dark City, which I have not seen in many, many years. Oh, and The Dark Knight, which is interesting in Blu-ray because it actually changes aspect ratio for the IMAX sequences.
Oh, neat. Hmm. I've got Planet Earth, which is incredible, absolutely incredible on Blu-ray. And then I really want to pick up Watchmen. I'm not sure if the... I might, on Watchmen, I might wait for the director's cut, which supposedly exists somewhere and just waiting to sort of be, you know, get some post-production on it. That's gonna look pretty fucking awesome on Blu-ray too. So James, for your new business,
yes.
I heard you're playing Professor Layton, but not the Professor Layton that just came out.
No, I'm not, because when I played it, I'm actually playing Mysterious Village. When I played it when it came out, you know, it was like one game on top of a pile of like 30.
Yeah.
And I played it a little bit, and then I more or less lost it, essentially.
Yeah, I do remember you discussing this when we had Windy on. I think this was the episode where Lords of Thunder first came up.
Lords.
No, it was when Lords of Thunder came up for the second time, actually.
Yes.
Never enough.
You know, I played it briefly, you know, and I felt like, well, I've seen what this game has to see. I'll probably come back and get it sometime. And basically, I was like, well, I probably should have played that game. And, you know, I was kind of, didn't have any cash on hand. And it was my 2-week, you know, every other week I go spend a bunch of money on games. And I had already spent that money on a used Wi-Fi adapter for the 360. So I basically went and I was like, well, I have Layton. I had like 3 or 4 games I'd never finished. And I'm not going to be a John Lindemann. So I went and I pulled out the original Layton. Started all the way at the beginning. Like, I didn't even remember the first, any of the puzzles I'd already played. So I was like, well...
It was a long time ago now, wasn't
it?
It was.
Like,
it was February?
Well over a year.
Of 2008,
I pulled it out... Yeah, something like that. I pulled it out the Sunday of Labor Day weekend. And by the Tuesday, I had completed all the puzzles in the game.
Good lord.
Well, that's pretty, yes. It's going a good clip.
Like, once I sat down and played it, that was it. I was done. I think I polished off the special challenge puzzles in a couple days after that, because those are brutal. But it was a very rock-solid gaming experience, I have to say.
Sounds like it really dug its teeth into you, man.
It did.
It's funny, because, I mean, I always thought of it as being perfect to not necessarily play in big chunks.
Right.
But I guess it goes to show that you can do it that way.
But that's what's weird about how I play games. I'll take games and play them for 6 straight hours, and then not touch them again for a week.
Hmm.
Which is, I mean, that's how Fossil Fighters went. I played it, one day I played it for 7 hours straight. I mean, I was watching TV at the same time, but...
And I guess, again, with Leighton, I mean, it's not necessarily completely demanding of your attention all the time. You know, it's not.
Yeah, there are times where it does.
You can sort of
demand.
Ponder a puzzle while sort of doing something else. You know, I mean, that's what it makes it a good travel game for a start.
And
I think.
The funny thing was, as I was starting the game, I didn't find it to be particularly challenging. You know, I completed that. There's the robot dog that you can get that helps you find everything else. I completed mm-hmm, that yeah. basically as early in the game as I think you probably could. So from that point on, it was pretty easy to find everything else, including the hidden puzzles, because you visit every site, you know, 50,000 times. So yeah. So eventually you're going to find yeah, it doesn't flow very nicely, and you have to bounce back.
No,
and forth.
It's like go back to the hotel. It's like really, I've already been back to the hotel like half a dozen.
I've already
times.
Been back to the hotel 10 times, and I am physically as far away from the hotel as I could manage to be right now.
I think I've heard that the sequel is a little better about directing you forward rather than have you kind of wander around looking for the next thing.
Well, what that did do is it basically meant that I found almost all the puzzles in the initial playthrough.
Yeah, and it was that way for me too when I first started, and I actually found it to be very distracting in that I could never really make progress in the story because while I was looking for the next story puzzle, the next piece of the adventure, I would find all these secret puzzles and end up doing those and get frustrated with those because they're more difficult.
Yeah.
And I would put the game down for a while. So, like, I wasn't... Like, when I eventually went back and finished Leighton, the approach I had to take was, screw the extra puzzles, I want to see the story. And, you know, I've heard that the sequel kind of does a better job of letting you do that. It's not quite as... OCD or
see, I was always really excited when I found a secret puzzle because a lot of the story puzzles and a lot of the ones you just get from talking to people, I found they were kind of easy. When I got these hidden ones that were, some of them were really hard. Some of them were just brutal. You know, I just enjoyed sitting there and, all right, what's going on here? What are they really trying to get me to do? Because usually I found that if you can figure out what they're trying to make you think, you can always assume that's wrong. And you can you can sort of work from there. So I think my favorite puzzle in the game discusses a space explorer who lands on this planet, and he starts counting these aliens. And you know, it's like 57 female, 86 male.
Oh no, yeah, I remember.
37 of both. How many aliens are on the planet? And the answer is one, because yeah, it's a space explorer.
Yeah.
And I start doing the math. I'm like, wait. Well, the fun thing about the game is you can usually draw on the puzzle while you're working on it. So I'm drawing out the math, and I'm like...
Yeah, pretty much any time you start actually doing somewhat complicated calculations, you're
this
wrong.
This is wrong.
Yeah, it never asks you to... It is logic rather than, you know, arithmetic processing power of your brain.
I'm like, yeah, this is wrong. They would never make me do this kind of math. But, oh, the answer is one, you fucking bastards.
The alien is you!
Yes, exactly.
An alien is you.
There's another one about reproducing mice that's the same kind of way. And those were my favorite because not only were they easy once you figured out what they were doing, but they were kind of funny when you... Because you kind of could kind of laugh at yourself for not realizing before how simple the puzzle is. But when... What I found to be... First off, I really did think the story was particularly good, even though the voice acting for was particularly bad. But
I like the story. I like the fact that there was actually a really great reason for why everyone wanted
yes.
to talk about puzzles. You know, but I don't think they could pull that trick twice.
No,
for the other
that's kind of, it's kind of a one-time deal.
Yeah,
it does make me wonder. Yeah,
like if that happened again, I would think at this point. Maybe it's time that he should go inform someone this is going on because maybe his whole world is like this. Maybe everyone he sees, yeah. maybe he is the puzzle. I mean, at this point, ideas of do I really exist come into play.
So, James, are you, what are your plans or what are your thoughts about the sequel? Or do you think you're going to pick it up?
Yeah, because I had the same experience with this game I had with the initial Phoenix Wright game, which is... I got to get inside my own head sometimes to think about what's really going on here. And, you know, there's a good story in both these games, and a lot of times, not just solving the puzzles the game presents you with, but solving the story helps you figure out what you need to do next. So, unfortunately, I'm almost certain to be picking up this next title well ahead in advance of my two-week schedule. Tomorrow, probably.
Breach of protocol, James. You tell that sort of thing.
It is. It is. It's, you know, the schedule's there to protect me from myself.
Oh, really? You've been doing a great job of that, hasn't it? Like, poor answer and crow mounds and all this shit.
Oh, yeah.
But no. But see, it's there. It's an economic protection system, because now that I think I have money, I can make it very quickly that I don't.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, just for example, you know, I know where you're coming from because I'm sitting there. They announced the Modern Warfare 2 Xbox console, and I'm looking at that. Now, bear in mind, I already have a 120 gig Xbox 360,
which apparently you don't even use very much.
Which I don't even use, before. but I'm sitting there saying, this is what goes through my head. I'm like, wow, I'm already getting that game anyways. That's a pretty cool looking console. And what I could do is I could buy it, and then I could sell my Elite that I have now. And I'm like, I'm retarded. What am I doing? Like, I don't even need this stuff. It's sad.
John's gonna actually have two 360s flanking his bed.
John, you don't even need a wife. You
can just buy everything you need. It's fine.
Don't need a liver, kidneys, blood. Don't need any of that stuff.
Yeah, it's just like...
John is the world stimulus package.
I am.
Spends.
It's pathetic.
Stuff.
Like, I cannot look at Amazon anymore because I just start to. It's bad, man.
Oh man, hey, I signed up for the the 30-day trial of Amazon Prime.
Oh, Amazon Prime's a killer, dude. It's a killer.
It was the free trial. I don't really think it's worth the annual fee. It's like $70
or
something.
Well, you make
it
worthwhile, trust me. It's also 2-day shipping for free. And a lot of times I'm like, who cares if I get this game today or Wednesday?
Yeah, with you, where there is a real irony about being concerned with the timeliness of it arriving, because it really only affects how long it will collect dust for.
Yes, I realize that. Believe me.
One more thing I wanted to note about. Oh yeah, in going through and playing all of the puzzles in Layton, including those Wi-Fi ones, which by and large weren't that great.
Quote
in my
unquote Wi-Fi ones.
Yes, the unlocked ones. I was kind of disappointed where basically all you get is, congratulations, you've beaten all the puzzles in my game. The end. Like, I really expect to do
Thank
something.
Thank you, Ghouls and Ghosts.
To do something.
What do you expect to do? Give you more puzzles? I mean,
well, no,
there's
I mean,
really
I mean,
nothing
like...
in Layton but the puzzles, mechanically
speaking.
Expected
to take his hat off, and underneath was a sort of miniature replica of Big Ben.
Another puzzle. Under his hat is another puzzle. Like, at least it be, like, an image to go with that text instead of just text on a background. I mean, my God.
Actually, would be awesome if you beat all the puzzles in Professor Layton 2. He puts on a gold bowler cap and turns into Henry Hatsworth.
Yeah.
God. Well, he must take the hat off because that stupid end puzzle, he had to put the hat thing there. That was the hardest fucking puzzle in the game, was the hotel. Which is as you collect hotel furniture and you assign it to either him
right,
or Luke.
Oh, right, yeah. That's the interior design thing. That?
Yeah, like I would always be
that.
Like one off. I'm like, who the fuck gets the round carpet? And then
who the fuck
that
cares
really is
more
just
like it?
Brutally pandering to your obsessive compulsive tendencies. That is this.
Yeah, it is.
Exploitation, really.
James, speaking of OCD, are you going to type in all 22,000 plus words in Scribblenauts?
I wish it told you how many in Scribblenauts, how many items you found. It might somewhere, but I haven't seen it.
It doesn't keep a list of the ones you've...
I think it does, but I haven't been able to find where it's kept. Like, it says you've unlocked a new category of items occasionally. So, like, one time I put in something like knives, and I was like, you've unlocked a new category of items. I'm like, what the hell kind of category of items is knives?
Dinnerware.
I don't know. It's weird. But the game is kind of hard, and in some ways it's ridiculously easy. Like, if you try to be imaginative and come up with creative solutions to the problems the game presents you, it can be really difficult. But there's like a series of six in a row that if you do helicopter, rope, attach rope to helicopter, get in helicopter, fly it to item, pick it up with rope, carry it back, you can solve.
Six levels in a row of the same solution. I mean, it seems like you're
well, that solution
it seems like
works.
You're doing it wrong, James. Because, I mean, the whole idea of Scribblenauts is that there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of
potential solutions. Well, I recognize that,
solutions.
But my point is that the creative solutions, a lot of times, are really difficult to pull off.
Right, but they should be more satisfying, right?
Yeah, they are, but it seems like the game basically, a lot of the puzzles are set up in such a way that there's a simple answer that works in a lot of the puzzles, because a lot of the puzzles are essentially the same. A lot of them are get item A to point B, but there is a hazard in the middle between point A and B that you have to look out for that is somehow adversely affects the item. and almost invariably you have to fly it over the hole somehow, or plug whatever the obstacle is. But if it's like there was three levels where you had to get a penguin back to its family, and the penguins don't follow you. So like I like built an iceberg bridge. I'm like, yeah, fuck you, killer whale. You're not getting to my penguins. And it just stands there. I'm like, I built you a fucking bridge. Go walk across it.
Maybe you should put the polar bear on the other side to chase the penguins over your bridge.
No, because the polar bear was faster than the penguin. I tried chasing it.
Can you put in Morgan Freeman and get him to tell them to go and cross the bridge?
I ended up attaching a rope to the penguin and then just dragging it across the ice.
By the way, polar bears don't eat penguins.
Polar bears eat everything in that game.
Polar bears eat seals.
Killer whales eat penguins.
Yeah, the whale is a bastard. And so one of my attempts to, like, I tried being creative. I'm like, well, maybe if I give the whale another whale, they'll distract each other. No, the other whale just ate the fucking penguin. I was like, well, that didn't work. Like, what if I give the whale a shark? They can fight each other. No, the whale just killed the shark, then ate the fucking penguin. I was like, alright.
The whale killed the shark?
The whale killed the shark.
That finally settled that debate, didn't it?
Mm? Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I guess so. Proof.
So, like I tried everything to just... And then I'm like, alright, fine, I'm just going to drag that bastard over there. And I just dragged him by the rope across the ice. And then, like, he gets over there and does... The characters can emote at you, living things. Mm. And it emoted that it was upset. I'm like, you fucker, I made an iceberg bridge for you. I clogged the polar ice caps to get you across this thing.
God, it's like a freaking Bryan Adams song.
God, you remind me of that.
I tried using bait one time to get it to go over there, and instead the other dumbass penguins I was trying to reunite it with jumped in the water and got eaten by the killer whale. I'm like, you freaking idiot.
One thing I'm interested in, I've heard, you know, there's some control issues with like directing the main character, that, you know, it's this sort of indirect thing, and it sometimes is not fully compliant with what you would want it to do. Is this...
Yes. So you move him around. Maxwell is the main character's name. Mm. Move him around by tapping on the screen, and he kind of runs to wherever you tapped. So if you hold down, you know, if you push down on in advance of Maxwell, and he's running, and the screen will pan, you know, he'll keep running because you're still pointing somewhere different. But you also interact with the objects by using the stylus. Well, let's say you tap on an object but just slightly miss. Maxwell's going to run to that object no matter where it is on the fucking map. So, like, I was manipulating objects way off screen to deal with a big lava pit. And I'm tapping on them, and I just slightly miss. I didn't realize I had missed, because I had the screen panned all the way over. Hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm notified that I failed, because Maxwell has jumped into the pit of lava.
Because he ran straight into it, trying to get to the point you pressed by accident.
Yes, right. Exactly. And I had no way of telling him, hey, don't run into the pit of lava while I manipulate this thing so there is no longer a pit of lava, you stupid idiot. But he just ran right into it, killed himself, and I had to basically restart the entire mission.
I wonder if this is something that could have been solved as easily as just, like, putting a lock icon on there or something.
Yeah,
or
that would have done it.
Or even mapping it to, like, a shoulder button. And, like, if you click L, Max won't move until you click L again. So, you know, you go into setup mode where you're typing in items and you're placing them all over the screen and you're kind of getting things set up, and then you unlock him once you're ready to start moving him around. I mean, it wouldn't have been hard.
No.
I wonder if they just thought that would be overcomplicating.
Probably streamline it as much as possible, but I mean, maybe you could have made it.
They're
optional.
Catching a lot of shit for this, though. Yeah. So I bet in the sequel or the ports to other systems or whatever happens with Scribblenauts in the future, I bet they're gonna look at some ways to address this.
The funny thing is, though, that Maxwell just happens to be my dog's name, and I got really pissed, and I'm like, Maxwell, you stupid shit. And my dog just looked at me and walked away. I was like, no, not you. Although you are stupid. I'm not talking to you right now.
Don't worry, I'll insult you later.
I did not, however, get Maxwell's rooster hat that you get as like a GameStop pre-order. But if you put that on, you instantly become an idiot.
Yeah,
I thought he was going to say Adonis then. I was so sure.
I do, however, think that the music for this game holds some promise in its just completely outlandishness. There's one where like it's just like these kids in the background counting, It's so weird. like something
from Sesame Street. Just,
no, it's like this really high-pitched, bizarre
thing in Street Fighter 4 where you're fighting in under an underpass and there's kids watching, and when you break someone's face, they go, yeah!
that's kind of what it's like, yeah.
Kids TV show.
That sounds just like every underpass I've ever seen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think it's a creative title, but I'm not sure that it is going to hold out very long.
Is it going to get repetitive, do you think?
It kind of already has. And yeah. Then, you know,
But if Scribblenauts is boring, doesn't that mean you're boring?
No.
I mean, isn't it that kind of game?
You're saying it bears a man's soul.
A lot of the things you think should work don't. It does reflect on me if I think the game isn't as exciting as I thought it would be, but there's not much you can do about it, I think. I think because a lot of the puzzles can be solved the same way over and over again, it's hard not to do it that way.
Yeah, I didn't mean to diss on you. I'm just saying that, like, if that's the approach you're going to take, like, if you're going to take the path of least resistance, then maybe it's just not the game for you.
Well, the thing is, though, I think it's a flaw in the actual design of the game. I mean, it's like, okay, well, you can solve it 20,000 different ways, but really, you only really need to solve stuff 5 different ways.
Well, it's not even just that. A lot of times, it's not necessarily you solve it exactly the same way, but the puzzles are so similar that there's really no reason to try to be creative, because...
You should try skipping ahead several, because, I mean, there's, like, over 200 puzzles in the game, so
yeah.
Maybe you just need to jump ahead to a new class of levels, you know? Maybe the levels are similar because they're all grouped together in a certain way.
Well, they're grouped by theme. Like, so this is a jungle level. This is a city level.
Yeah.
This is a castle level. Castle levels fucking suck.
Well, it does seem like the kind of game that different people are going to come away with dramatically different readings on it. And
well,
I'm definitely hoping to pick it up for myself in the near future. So
I would say that it could be a really solid rental for most people. And there will be some people who will absolutely love this game and play it for a billion hours.
Is it the kind of game that makes a really good first impression? People that saw it at E3, do you think it's because they only played it for a short time? They're like, oh my
yes,
god, this is so novel and so cool and so neat. But after a while, you would get sick of it.
I would say it makes a fantastic first impression. It's the second impression that has the problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I was worried about. But most of the reviews that I've seen so far have been... you know, not completely outlandishly good because of some of the control problems that you've talked about, the pathfinding for the character. But aside from that, it seems like the game really does do what you would want it to do, and they've been very praising of the level designs too, and maybe they just played more of them, or they found the ones that they liked, or I don't know.
Yeah, right? Well, like I found that sometimes the level designs are really creative, and sometimes they just aren't. It's pretty all over the place.
Like Bengayo Spirits was for me. I got plenty of play out of Bengayo, so.
Yeah.
Alright, well, I guess I'm going to wrap up this big, hearty new business. Being that we had 2 weeks worth of time to play games, you know, I played a lot of games. In fact, I played more than I'm even going to talk about today. As I mentioned before, I did get a PS3, and I've only got one game for it so far, which I'll talk about in a minute, but I did play a lot of demos and stuff on it. And maybe I'll get around to some of those later. But the first game I'll talk about is Muramasa the Demon Blade for Nintendo Wii.
First Wii game we've actually had on this podcast.
No.
Aside from Dirt 2?
Yeah, Dirt 2, that's right. Poor I mean, job. That's multi-platform, but yeah.
It couldn't have been John talking about a Wii game. I wasn't imagining
It's like I'm not even here.
Okay,
oh, sad. John, you're so here. You're so here. So Muramasa is it is a really cool game, and I will admit that I rented it, and I'm glad that I rented it just because of the kind of gamer that I am and the kind of stuff that I like. This is a game that I would not play all the way through. Like, I'm not saying that it's not worth buying, because I think there is definitely a contingent of people out there who will want to buy this and who will want to play all the way through it. It seems like a very respectably long game. At least in terms of art, it does keep offering you new things to do as you go through it, new things to look at least. But that's part of the problem that I have with it, and I'm not really complaining. This is just the nature of the game. It's just kind of a disconnect between me and my personal taste in the game, but this game leverages its aesthetics so much as opposed to gameplay. And I am primarily a game design kind of a player. Like, I'm in it for the levels, I'm in it for the abilities, I'm in it for, you know, the senses of accomplishment or the sense of progression and development. Like, I talk about these things week in and week out, and really none of that is in Muramasa. I mean, it is a very, mechanically, it's a very, very simple game. You have maybe 10 moves that you can do with your sword.
Something like that, yeah.
And you can do those from the start of the game, and you don't really ever learn anymore. So, I mean, you have one special move that's dependent on the particular sword that you're using at the time. And some of those are more useful than others, but you just push a button to use it. So the enemies don't, the strategy you have to take with the enemies, it doesn't seem to change all that much, and you fight a lot of the same enemies over and over. So it is a very methodical kind of a game. It's all about the sword play, and like I said, it's not exceptionally difficult. I mean, the way that they make the game more difficult is not really throwing different tactics or different kinds of enemies at you. It's just the enemies do more damage, or you do less.
Yes.
And so you have to go grind a little more and or forge a new sword that's better than the one you had before, and then you go back to that boss or whatever and do it again. And it is a little bit RPG-ish in that way, but it's not grabbing hold of me, I guess. I mean, it's a game that I've been going back to every day, and I feel like I enjoy it now more than I did the first couple days I had it, because I understand it better. But I feel like I'm kind of reaching the limits of the depth.
The zenith of game enjoyment.
Yeah, I mean, Muramasa, it is just, you play it for the pretty art. And I like pretty art, but it's not enough to keep me playing through the entire game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for some people, I'm sure it will be. It is very, very, very beautiful. It is stunning.
See, I actually had a lot of fun playing, and I think I played the demo 2 or 3 times at E3, because I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, and I did too. I mean, I was with you at E3, but just realize that you played everything the game has to offer at E3.
Nice.
Like, it doesn't really grow out from there, you know? Like, it doesn't get more complex or more engaging. Like, it is very satisfying in short bursts, but it's like a 20-hour game.
Well, I think if you play the both stories or whatever, isn't it? It's like adds up to 20 something. Yeah,
sure. But even with one character, I mean, I already am kind of getting tired of it. I'm not nearly.
Yeah,
well,
that's what I was more thinking. Does it? You know, I mean, it doesn't sound like you'd get anywhere near wanting to play it with a second character.
Right.
When presumably at that point you've run out of seeing new stuff if you're gonna go with a second character.
It could be. I mean, you get a different story, but the story is so batshit crazy.
It's very, very Japanese. Like,
oh, everything about this game is super, super Japanese. And I'm not that much of a Japanophile, so that's part of the disconnect here also, is that, you know, like, I don't watch a ton of anime. Like, there has to be something particularly special about an anime movie, you know, like a Miyazaki movie or something. I might watch that. But just your run-of-the-mill, kind of average anime stuff, I'm not going to give it the time of day, because I don't give a fuck. Like, it just because it's Japanese doesn't really do it for me. And Muramasa, you know, I'm not saying it's totally average or run-of-the-mill, but it is leaning very hard on its appeal as being hardcore Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that just doesn't do much for me. I mean, I think the issue with Muramasa, for me personally, is that, you know, if I beat a boss or I get to a new place, the reward or the thing that is new about, you know, the sense of progression you get is that here's a new background. I mean, you might get a new sword, but the new sword, it doesn't really do anything different.
It's just statistical. It's just shifting numbers back and forth.
It's like getting a new sword in Dragon Quest. I mean, whoop-de-doo.
And it's not just you get a new sword. It's that it's just another sword in the list, basically.
Yeah, it's not like getting a new sword in a Zelda game. There's like 100 swords in the game, so getting a new one's
really
not that
like,
big of a,
I think,
it's not
I
a big
think
deal.
In the 15-minute demo, you got 5.
But, I mean, again, you know, the reward for getting to a new place or for making progress in the game is you get to look at something new. And so,
with
you know, if that's really important to you, then it's worth it. I enjoy the art. I would like the new art to be paired with something new that I can do also, but it's not there. The game is just very, it's a very shallow game. But it is extremely well made. very finely crafted. It's very smooth, and it is, I'd say, mildly addictive in a weird way. I haven't really been able to pinpoint why, but I'm not going to keep it much longer. Like I said, it was a good rental for me, but I do think for a lot of people, would be very happy with their purchase of it. It certainly does more to keep itself fresh than like some of the beat 'em ups we've had this year, you know, like Mad World and stuff like that. I mean, Mad World's also a game that leverages itself on aesthetics very much, but
it isn't finely crafted.
It's not as finely crafted, no, and it also doesn't have all these RPG type systems like Muramasa does.
Progressive what?
I think Vanillaware, the developer, was very wise to put in things like level ups and earning and purchasing new swords, because even though it doesn't make a really tangible difference in the way the game plays, it does make you feel like you're accomplishing something, and it kind of pushes you forward because it needs that, because the gameplay, it's just very repetitive, I guess I would say. So for the PS3, the only real disc game that I've got so far is Infamous. I'm not really sure why I picked up Infamous.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a strange choice.
Well,
John's mocking your choice in games now.
No, I mean, it's just, it's not like one of the big games for the system. Like,
I'm intrigued by this. What would you say? What could Johnny have said that wouldn't have surprised you? Let me put it that way.
Like Metal Gear Solid 4 or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
You said games, John, not movies. Games.
I don't know. I guess I got a pretty good deal on it. I think I paid like $40 for it new or something. But it didn't come out that long ago.
Yeah.
But then also, my very first game for Xbox 360 was Grand Theft Auto 4, which is a game that I ended up not really enjoying that much.
But it definitely was
a good value for the money.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe that's what I was thinking when I ordered Infamous. But anyway, Infamous is an open-world game, sort of like GTA 4, but not really. It's not nearly as much leverage on just kind of running around and doing random stuff. You know, it's more story driven, but the story isn't oppressive, make you want to slit your wrist kind of shit like it is in GTA 4.
Yeah.
I don't want to live anymore.
It's also not as disastrously comedic, I guess.
Yeah.
And Infamous has a nice comic book feel to it. You know, your main character he's like basically a superhero. He has all these electrical powers, and I thought that was interesting, and I liked hearing some of the stuff. I remember seeing videos or something of the main character jumping around and using static electricity to make himself kind of float, and then also like grinding along cables and train tracks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that's really, really cool. Like, I like these ways of getting around the environment.
Yeah, it's a very fun game to just hop into and just run around and do stuff. It's kind of like Crackdown in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Like Crackdown. Right.
That's what John does in his day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
Crackdown's a much better comparison, and that is a game I really love. And Infamous I like a lot. I really think it's very well made. The story's okay, I guess. But mainly, I like the powers. It is very much a third-person shooter. More than I expected, actually. But there's a lot of hiding behind cover, or at least running around and kind of strafing around while you shoot at guys with your lightning bolts.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very little like melee kind of combat. I mean, you can do it, but a lot of times the guys shooting you are on other buildings. You know, they're on rooftops around, so it just makes more sense to just shoot at them.
Yep.
And so there ends up being a lot of shooting, but it's a really fun game. The controls are very good. You know, it's a lot of fun to just kind of explore the environment, look for little secret things, get new powers. So I'm enjoying it. It's not the greatest game ever, but it's good. And in the end, for whatever reason I originally chose it to be my first PS3 game, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
I'm pretty happy with it.
I mean, when I started playing it, you know, I was just like, I pretty much had exactly the same reaction. It's like, this is nothing truly groundbreaking, you know, it's not going to change the way you look at the world, but, mm-hmm. you know, it was just, I just picked it up and I said, wow, this is a fun game to just run around and just throw in and play, and, you know, you can kind of drop in, drop out of it.
It's nicely challenging, and also the missions they give you, I feel like have a pretty good variety for the, you know, the kinds of objectives, the kinds of gameplay that you end up getting drawn into. It doesn't get boring.
Yeah.
They keep adding new things. I mean, I just played this weird mission where I had to ride around on an electrified bus all over the city and try to defend this bus as swarms and swarms of dudes hopped out of the alleys and started shooting rocket launchers at it. And it wasn't my favorite mission because it was really difficult, but it was completely different than anything I'd done before. And plus, it made sense in the context of the story and the abilities of the character, so I thought it was a very cool idea for a mission. So, the last game that I've been playing a fair bit of is Beatles Rock Band, and I actually got this for 360. So yes, I have a game from all three consoles this week. I am totally doomed. My personal life is just doomed having three consoles. But Beatles Rock Band, have any of you guys gotten it yet?
Nope.
No.
Any interest?
Nope.
Eh. Maybe.
None. Beatles can die in a fire.
Oh my god.
Not a fan at all of the Beatles.
We're not friends anymore.
Here comes the hate mail.
Greg, tell me that you like the Beatles.
You know, I mean, the Beatles are one of these things I've always heard enough to know that, you know, I
heard
like
enough Nike
well
commercials.
Enough, but, oh god. But I've never actually gone and got the back catalogue or whatever. So, I mean, they're re-releasing them now, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they just
all the remastered.
This whole game has turned into is part of a massive media campaign.
Yeah, sort of cross-media Beatles renaissance or whatever. So I think I would probably look at the music before the game, I think.
Okay.
Because I've never really familiarized myself with it.
Yeah, it is part of like a big, you know, media blanket blitzkrieg. But I have to say the game is really, really well done. And it's not dramatically different than the other Rock Band games, as you might expect. But I think the differences that are there are very meaningful. And they really do set it apart and make it feel quite a bit different than Rock Band 2, which is the best point of comparison I have. And also Guitar Hero 5, which I only played... I've actually, you know, I mentioned I had some disc problems. I've sent that back in. I'm waiting to get it back from Activision. So I still haven't played a lot of that. But Beatles Rock Band is the first rhythm game to make me feel like presentation actually matters. And it kind of gives me a window into what presentation can do for these games. Because before, yeah, I've always thought that the guys running around on stage and playing guitar and singing in the microphones and all that in these games, it was there because it was necessary, but...
Yeah, it's
cares?
Like they had to have something in the background, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. It's either that or a visualizer. And
yeah.
That might even be more distracting. So it doesn't do anything for me. I don't feel like I'm that guy, you know, playing in the background. I don't look at him while I'm playing the
you
game.
You are
I don't
the
really,
guy.
I don't really look at him even if I'm watching someone else play the game. I'm probably just mesmerized by the note highway.
Yeah.
But in the Beatles Rock Band, the presentation is pretty striking, actually, and they've done a lot of things. For one thing, it's a lot more colorful than all those other games, so it really makes you, it kind of catches your eye a lot better. And also, it really captures the flavor of the Beatles, which, that might sound trite, but I mean, it makes a difference. Like, you can tell they've really tried. It's not like Guitar Hero Aerosmith, where it's just weird, creepy models of Aerosmith running around in the background.
Yeah.
Like, with the Beatles, they've really captured it. They do things like really sharp, very smart, clever things that I wouldn't have thought of. Like, you know, if you're playing at Shea Stadium with the Beatles, it's their big stadium tour in the U.S. back in the early 60s. That's after Ed Sullivan and all that. It's in the height of Beatlemania, which is totally, you know, obnoxious, a dark mark upon pop music history, perhaps, Beatlemania. But, you know, they've got the audience cheering up so loud in the mix that I had to go to the options and turn it off because it was just obnoxious. Yeah, but even then, after that, I'm playing through these songs, and they're, you know, very familiar songs, they're great songs, and I'm playing through them, and I'm kind of catching out of the corner of my eye in the graphics that it's not just the Beatles hopping around on stage playing their instruments. They're showing all kinds of different diverse reactions from people in the audience. Some people are kind of into it. You got some older people who aren't really sure what to think. And then they cut to like the cops, the policemen who are kind of standing in front of the stage, keeping the girls from climbing up onto John and Ringo. And the cops have their fingers in their ears because it's so loud and the girls are just screaming nonstop. And it really gives you a sense of time and place that you don't get in any of these other games. And being a very big Beatles fan, I mean, it means more to me because I recognize a lot of these references, and I care about the, you know, how the character models look, you know, that they don't look like skeletons or that they don't look like puppets.
I think part of the reason that they had to do this was because, I mean, let's be honest, they paid a lot of money for this property. And I think a big portion of that comes down to we have such a big cultural element to this that we should use it as much as we can and leverage it in such a way that it is to the best benefit of the title.
Yeah, well, right. I think also they're trying to go, you know, I would have thought that their goal would be to be a bit more of a crossover product, you know, that this is going to go beyond the usual rhythm game fan base and all that, you know, that this could be as mainstream as you might say a lot of these games have become already. Even more mainstream because the Beatles are just have this resonance with so many people, and particularly older people, that they're trying to sort of get into the wallets of. And for them, I think the cultural callbacks and the nostalgia and all that is going to be a lot more important than necessarily just the nuts and bolts of the gameplay, at least to begin with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you try to get that positive buzz going amongst that particular set, I think it's absolutely key to get these things right.
But I think what it shows is that presentation is important. It does catch people's attention. It does give you a different impression of the game. Even someone like me who's played a bunch of these games before, I know what the score is, you know, like I know what this game's all about. I'm in it for the songs, right? I'm in it because of the selection of music. Mm-hmm. Then I get into it and I end up appreciating Beatles Rock Band on levels that I didn't really expect because they have taken so much care into the presentation, into some of these little extra features that they stick in. And, you know, it makes me think about the band more than I had recently. And I'm singing their songs to myself all day long, even when I'm not playing the game. And there's a little bit of magic to it that hasn't been in a lot of these other games. I mean, I find that a lot of the rhythm games are very soulless.
Yeah.
And just very mechanical. And as a fan of the mechanics of those games, it's not necessarily a problem. It's not an impediment to my enjoyment of them. But I can understand where it would be for a lot of other people, especially people who don't play these games a lot. So I think Harmonix has hit upon a segment of these games that was not really fully developed before. And what I'm really interested to see is how they now apply what they've learned in doing this game to other games that they make. Because I think this kind of approach would even work. I mean, you know, it'd have to be a little more pulled back a little bit for a game with, you know, 50 or 60 different bands in it. You can't do this kind of lavish production for every single one of those bands. But I mean, I think in terms of putting more thought into the presentation and what's going on with the graphics, you know, the dreamscapes where you're floating through the ocean looking at the yellow submarine, and there's some really crazy shit. I mean, Helter Skelter and some of that other stuff, there's some like actually disturbing stuff. Within Without You has very bizarre imagery, very abstract kind of stuff, and it's awesome. It's like, man, why don't they do this in other rhythm games? It's like, well, they never had to before. But with the Beatles, you kind of have to do that. There is one of the marks against Beatles Rock Band, I guess, is the song list. For one thing, it's only about 45 songs, which I feel like is not really enough for a, you know, a big $60 game. Not when, you know, you look at Guitar Hero 5, which costs the same and has like 85 songs, almost twice as many for the same price. And yeah, they're all over the place in terms of quality, but unfortunately, so are the songs on Beatles Rock Band. I mean, there's shit like Dig a Pony, which I'd never even heard before yesterday.
I've heard it, but I'm not sure why it's included.
It's not good, and it's not fun to play, and it shouldn't be in that game. And I was talking about this with a couple of friends over the weekend as we were playing it, and I wonder if they left out some songs because they know damn well that they can sell them as DLC.
Mm-hmm. And sure they did.
Actually buy it. And I wonder if they included some songs because maybe the developers happened to like them, but they knew it had no commercial appeal as DLC.
Yes. You know,
stuff like Boys. What the fuck is that? It's like from the Cavern Club days, it's Ringo singing. It's not good. It's not a good song. Like, why is that in the game? And you have to wonder, well, you know, Ringo was a consultant on this. Maybe it's like one of his pet favorite songs. And he kind of insisted that it be in there, but they thought, man, we can never put this out as DLC because nobody's going to pay for this. I don't know. There's a little bit of a cynical side to it, unfortunately, that I think you can't escape once you kind of look at the song list. And there's just not really any rhyme or reason to why those songs were selected to be put in the game. Some of them I'd never heard before and I really like, and I'm glad that I was exposed to them. But some of them I'm like, God, why? Why? It's not that big of a deal because the game is excellent. It's very, very good at what it does. And if you're not very familiar with the Beatles, holy shit. Okay. That's the end of new business.
That was his advice. His advice is, holy shit.
Yep. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with a news roundup. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. It's been 2 weeks since the last RFN, and the crew at Nintendo World Report has been extra busy. To start things off, make sure you start playing Geist on GameCube in preparation for the next RFN Retroactive featuring Geist producer Jeff Callis.
We've posted an abundance of new screenshots and trailers from upcoming titles such as Pit Trip Void, Bonk Brink of Extinction, and Mario & Sonic at the Olympic Winter Games. And for a great read, check out our interview with Fifth Cell's Jeremiah Slashka, in which we discuss Scribblenauts, Drawn to Life 2, and much, much more.
Also check out our coverage of the recent WiiWare and DSiWare Summit in London, England. UK correspondent Mark Kelly provides impressions of Super Meat Boy and Lost Winds 2, as well as an interview with Frontier's David Braben.
Of course, always check NintendoWorldReport.com for daily Nintendo news and reviews. Nintendo World Report, 10 years strong. Well, as a lot of our listeners might have noticed, the NWR newscast hasn't really gone anywhere lately, so we figured there have been a lot of game announcements. Oddly enough, in the fall, you think games get released more than announced, but there have been quite a few announcements lately, as well as a couple other little developments, and so we thought it might be cool to go through and do one of our, you know, tri-monthly news segments, and Greg actually pulled up this list, and he took the lead on this, so he's going to take charge of the discussion here and guide us through it.
Yeah, so this is basically stuff while we were away kind of thing developed during the break. Not all of it's necessarily the most current stuff, but there's some interesting stuff included. An absolute avalanche of digital distribution stuff. But the first one is a retail game coming out of Japan, and this is Okami Den, the sequel on the DS to Okami, which is apparently coming in sometime in 2010. It's going to be at TGS pretty soon. I mean, TGS is really soon, right?
Yeah, it's like next week.
So, yeah, first of all, just general thoughts on the fact that there's going to be a sequel to Okami on the DS.
Why the hell not?
I'm excited, but like, why would Capcom greenlight this, considering the abysmal sales of the console version?
Well, I mean, that's probably why it's on the DS. I mean, this is probably
the popularity of DS, I guess.
Yeah, but obviously we're dealing with a pretty big user base on PS2.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, I mean, are there really any other games like this on DS? I mean, it's because it's going to actually be like, I mean, it's going to be 3D, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you've seen the media, you know, you've got the cel-shaded graphic style, you know, polygonal, mm-hmm. all that. It's all there in place. I think what interests me about it is that when you think about Okami on Wii, there were really too many things going on for all the buttons in that game, which led to some of the farcical gesture stuff like the dodging, which didn't work.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how they translate the gameplay where there were, you know, not enough buttons on the Wii controller to handle it to the DS. It's probably going to go a lot more in the kind of Ninja Gaiden, Dragon Sword, Phantom Hourglass kind of direction, I would have mm-hmm. thought. And combat will have to change somewhat. It may well be much less combat-focused game now, and I would have thought it would be more puzzle-based, which I'd be amenable to that.
Too much combat in Okami.
Yeah, Exactly. I think so. I didn't think it was the strongest part of the game. I guess that part of it definitely wasn't helped by the Wii controls with the dodging and the flailing to do everything. But with this, you know, apparently some of the new mechanics, you've got the celestial brush is coming back, and as you'd expect, you've got the stylus control for that. But you've also got, you played this little chibi-fied version, essentially, of the character from the first one, who gets ridden around on by sort of human partner characters, and you're able to control them using the stylus as well. So sounds like it could be a bit Spirit Tracks-y in terms of, you know, with the phantom guy that you're going to be kind of controlling alongside. Sounds like that kind of single-player co-op kind of stuff could well be going on here as well.
Well, I think aside from, you know, continuing some of the great gameplay stuff from Okami, I think the most exciting part for me is just that Okami was very much a Zelda clone, or a game patterned after the Zelda games, and that's one of the great things about it. Is like, it's a big, epic adventure. Yeah. You know, there's a story, there's a lot of stuff to do, there's a lot of places to explore, and it really gives you that Zelda vibe. That's where I feel like on the DS, there aren't very many games that do that. You basically got Nintendo's soon-to-be two Zelda games, and beyond that, there aren't that many games that really pull that off. And so I'm excited to have another game in that vein, and also something to compete with, you know, stuff like Spirit Tracks and really push Nintendo a little bit.
No, I definitely agree with that. But like I said, I think it lends itself more to puzzle solving, because I think that was probably, in the end, the sort of tiebreaker in some ways between sort of Okami and Zelda for me. Is I love the puzzle stuff in Zelda. I love that part of the dungeon. So that was not a huge focus in the Okami, relatively. I mean, it's in there, some of it, but hopefully it'll be in this more, and that I would like that.
We can assume this game's going to play like its predecessor, right?
Well, we don't really know yet. We'll know.
No, you don't really
GGS.
Know for sure. I mean, what we do know in terms of the development side is this is internal at Capcom, which is obviously different from, you know,
right.
It was the Clover, now Platinum guys that did it before. And I think it's been directed by the chap who oversaw the Wii port, who has worked on Dino Crisis games, so I don't know about that.
Oh, good. It'll be perfect. There'll be giant dinosaurs hidden in corners you can't see.
I think there's a producer from the Phoenix Wright series on this. I don't know whether that really shows Hugh James anymore.
So that just confuses the hell out of
you don't know how to reconcile those two things, though. Dino Crisis.
I can see a Phoenix Wright Dino Crisis, but throwing Okami in there is just too much. I mean,
Dino Wright.
Dino. All right, well, we'll move on to the next one. The next story I've got is about Nintendo announced their fall/winter schedule, kind of slotting a lot of things we already did know about. First of being Bee Spirit Tracks, that's coming December 7th. Oddly, they still haven't actually said exactly when New Super Mario Bros. Wii is going to come out. It still just says holiday.
I'm going to say a few days before Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
I know. It's like, isn't that, we all know that. Like, why not just say it at this point?
I don't understand
what's up in the
air. I
think
they're intentionally holding it back so they can make a separate announcement and make it seem like a big deal.
Perhaps so.
Really?
I totally agree. I mean, why have it buried in the middle of a big list?
The Smash Brothers Brawl Dojo approach to release dates being trickled out, I think.
Exactly.
Now. But what was more interesting on the list was stuff we didn't know about necessarily before. A lot of that's the digital stuff, so including loads of stuff. But BitTrip Void is on there, so we kind of found out about this recently. It's the next BitTrip game. I don't really know a whole lot about it beyond that.
It's like, from what I can tell, you control a black hole, and I think there's still sort of things, you know, dots coming in from the outside of the screen. I don't know if they're flying straight or if they're moving around or whatever, but you control a black hole, and you can actually move it freely around the screen, which is a lot different than the first two BitTrip games. Mm. And I think the idea is you push a button to make it bigger or shrink it or something, and you use it to catch the notes as they come in from off the screen. And they're also adding checkpoints to it, which is greatly needed. So, yeah, BitTrip Void, it sounds like it's a good evolution of that series.
Yeah, it was slotted on the list for quarter three, which should make it any week now that it would come out.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
If that would be accurate, I guess that's pretty much consistent with the timetable that we've had so far. But kind of more of other stuff coming, DSi West side, you've got Art Style Digidrive, which you're pretty safe to assume it's the Bit Generation's DigiDrive.
You don't have to assume it. I confirmed this with Dylan Cuthbert. Yeah.
I think it's possible it may have a different name in Europe because there was a rating that covered up Art Star Intersect, and I would be surprised if that's not Digidrive because that is what the game is. You're
right.
Like, mucking around with an intersection.
It's like traffic control, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is the one of the Bit Generations that was not developed by Skip. It was developed by Q Games, so it's nice to see it get another chance. I really like this one.
Right.
And it's of course, unlike the other specific Bit Generations games, this is not coming out on Wii. It's coming out on DS instead.
Right.
But it's very suitable for handheld, no doubt about that.
Yeah, this probably would not work as well as a WiiWare game, I think. Compared to something like Orbient.
No.
Yeah, Digidrive, the DSiWare version, is developed by Q Games, and that's sort of significant in that they've only made the pixel junk stuff for about the past, like, 3 years.
Yeah, so it's been a while now.
It's been a while since they made anything, especially for a Nintendo platform. This will be the first thing they've made for DS since Star Fox Command.
Which was 2006, and actually right. Digidrive was 2005, so it's not really much older.
Right, yeah. But I don't think this will be the last thing that they make.
I certainly hope not, because I really like that, and I'll be checking out Pixel Junk stuff pretty soon, I should think.
Oh, yeah, the demos, they're really good.
Yeah.
I'm going to be putting down some money on those next week.
Pixel Junk Eden is great.
The other notable DSiWare thing that came up was Shantae, which is the way forward thing from the Game Boy Color back in the beginning of this decade or whatever. It's going to be getting a sort of three-part episodic DSiWare series, apparently, that's going to start launching at the end of this year. Quite an interest. It's been talked about that they wanted to do something with it for ages on various different configurations, whether it's GBA or just a DS game, whatever, and it turns out to be episodic on DSiWare. Quite strange.
I'll believe it when I see it, because Shantae Shantae's sequel is such vaporware.
I think what we've seen this time, I think we really are going to get something, though I'm not sure we're going to want what we get.
We'll see. I mean, I bet they've learned a lot from doing Boyan's Blob.
Yeah, and I mean, they've already done something on DSiWare with Mighty Flip Champs, which is quite well thought of. It was a completely different kind of thing. I'm not really educated on Shantae. Is anyone here actually that familiar with it?
She runs around and dances and kills enemies.
It's a platformer.
It's basically a platformer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all it is.
I think people liked it mostly for the art design.
Yeah, it was very pretty.
It was kind of an interesting game. I mean, it wasn't... I wouldn't call a 9, maybe a 7 or an 8 in my mind. I mean, it
so you've played through quite a bit of it, James.
Yeah, I have. But I played it so long ago, I mean...
Yeah, well, it's I never getting on it. For like 10 years ago now,
it's,
I guess.
I think it was 02 is when it came out. So
well, I know, even at the time, it was very hard to find.
Yes, it was extremely hard to find, which is odd because it's a Capcom game and they're usually okay about that.
Well, I guess it was just because it was such a late... If it was 2002, that was an incredibly late Game Boy Color game.
It was.
It was.
It's well into the GBA phase at that point.
Yeah, but I remember it actually got a relatively big media buy, though, because I remember they had it on the back of a bunch of game magazines for a few months, but then you couldn't find the damn game.
I guess that may add to the kind of the legend of it, but you know, I like what I've played of WayForward stuff so far, so I might be interested in it if I ever did get a DSi. Alright, we'll get on to more downloadable sequels. We've got Lost Winds 2, Winter of the Melodias, however that would be pronounced, is coming apparently in October, according to the European release schedule. So I'm not sure they're quite as committed to that in America, but presumably there wouldn't be a big delay between the two, so it's pretty soon.
Yeah, we also have some coverage on the site for this. We have an interview up with David Braben from Frontier.
We have
a
site?
Also have a preview of it. Yes, we do have a site, and people should check it out if they like the podcast.
I think the season switching stuff from winter to summer, it sounds cool. You know, it's been done in Zelda, and I think it'll work well for this, especially with the environmental weather type mechanics that are already in Lost Winds. But the thing that irks me, I guess, about Lost Winds 2, I just watched a video of it today, and you still can't jump with the main character. You still have to pick him up with the wind, even for the smallest little hops up a ledge. And that is so, I don't know,
cumbersome.
It's so unnecessary. It's cumbersome, because it's like when I was talking about Nick's quest a few weeks ago, I was like, you know, the great thing about this is the powers actually are similar to Lost Winds. I mean, the game is very similar to Lost Winds in a lot of ways, but it treats you like a grown-up because it lets you and actually requires you to do two things at once. You have to move the character including jumps and double jumps and glides and all of that. So you're doing all of that with one hand, and on the other hand, you're using your omnipotent abilities to manipulate the environment and set things up. And sometimes, you know, you have to time these things all together. And I just, Lost Winds 2, it's like, come on, let me jump with the character. Like, I still, there's plenty to do with the cursor, moving the wind around and, you know, making cyclones and all this stuff. There's plenty to do. You don't have to put jumping on it, too. It just really bothered me in the first game, and it's going to bother me in this one, too, but I'll probably still pick it up because it looks like it's really well made.
Well, I mean, I kind of agree with you. I like that more involved, the, you know, the control that you would have if you kind of blended the two rather than sort of just chose one over the other. But one thing that they're promising is that it's going to be significantly longer. Apparently, they're just, you know, more efficient or whatever and using the size constraint. So the sort of primary complaint, of quite a lot of people about the first game being that it was about, was it 3 hours? Was that being generous, or was it 90
Maybe,
minutes?
I'd say about two hours.
Two, yeah. I wonder to what extent it's going to be leveraged on having played the first one at all. You know, in terms of, apparently you will begin it with all the attributes that you would have gained in the first one. So it will continue on in that sense, but presumably they'll make it accessible to people that haven't played the first one, because I'd be quite happy to just jump in at this if it's just more interesting and more polished and longer and all that sort of thing.
You know, the first one was $10 for like a 2-hour game. I'm wondering, it's been quite a long time since we had a WiiWare game that was more than $10. I'm wondering if they think this one is sufficiently longer, and even the first one had great production values, you know, it's a beautiful game. I'm just wondering if they feel like this is a big game. You know, this is the sequel to the biggest WiiWare launch title. I'm wondering if they think maybe we can do $15 on this one. Maybe it's worth it.
There's two opposite sort of pressures. I mean, on the one hand, if yes, you could demonstrate that it's significantly bigger, better than that game, then you could go higher. And I mean, we've seen games go higher. Was it Crystal Chronicles? It was $1,500, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then as you fell into the pit of DLC, it became increasingly expensive.
But I suppose the counter to it be going up is that WiiWare is so much more competitive now.
Yes,
in the sense that you were as a launch window thing, it was a pretty prime spot to be in. You know, those two sort of fairly premium priced games, Lost Winds.
They were it, and
I'm sure it really helped the sales. A bit different now. It's really gathering steam. So I'll be intrigued to see where they go with that. I would guess they'd end up just holding firm on it, so it may end up being better value for money at $1,000.
Yeah, that'd, I mean, it has, if they're going to charge the same amount, it has to be not just longer but substantially longer.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, and so maybe that's what will have happened. They just kind of caught up. The next WiiWare game we're going to talk about is Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth, which was sort of exposed by the ESRB rating at first. It's since been confirmed by Nintendo and Konami in various capacities, so we think this is coming pretty soon as well. Q3 release slot from Nintendo. Now these things are pretty fluid, obviously, as we know with like Cave Story. Like, hasn't that been slotted to come out in like every quarter this year?
Every
still haven't got it yet.
but that game is literally not finished, so it's not a matter of Nintendo pushing it back. It's the developers just a perfectionist.
I assume that's the developers tell them something and then they put it in a release schedule and then that changes or whatever. But with this, I think I feel fairly confident it will probably be coming out pretty soon. But what? So I guess one can only assume that it's going to be a much more traditional Castlevania than we've had in quite a while, because that's what the rebirths are.
You'd think that, but then they call it The Adventure. And the old school Castlevanias, I don't think of those as adventures. Those are action games.
No, but it's a reference, presumably, to Castlevania the Adventure, the launch game for the Game Boy in 1989, which was pretty much derided as being terrible, especially in retrospect. Although the sequel of Belmont's Revenge is much, much better thought of. So, I mean, I wonder what that means. I mean, is they just going to say, well, you know, we wanted it to be the Belmont that had the first name of the guy in the Game Boy game or whatever? I mean, it was so trivial. Or is it something about the play mechanics that were in that one that apparently weren't very good? I mean, it's weird because, you know, Konami's other ones, you know, Gradius and Contra, they were just so totally general. You know, it's not Contra 3 Rebirth.
Right.
Or Grady's Gaiden Rebirth.
It really makes you wonder what this is going to be, and they still haven't shown it or really said anything about it.
No.
So we're left guessing. But shit, I'm excited. Not as much as Greg, but I'm excited.
Bizarre subs franchise pigeonholing aside, it is being developed by M2 again, who are the emulation people that developed the other Rebirth games. And I think Contra was definitely a step forward on Gradius, so there's reason to be optimistic there. But the other thing is with Contra, they had, like, the guy that directed Contra 3 and the Mega Drive 1 Hardcore, he worked in some capacity, God knows how involved it is, with M2 on Rebirth. So, I mean, if you got, and I think Igarashi was given some sort of credit as well, although I was playing through the Japanese version, so it just came up Iga in big letters. I don't know what
that's what his business card says.
It could have been. It could have been.
Iga.
Could have been special thanks for whatever, being the T-boy for a day.
Yeah. But he actually calls himself Iga. Like, yeah, that's his
it.
Thing.
Yeah,
it's like sort of like Suda 51.
I guess it is. Yeah. But that means it's somewhat possible that he could be involved in it. But the weird thing about that is, has he ever even done a linear Castlevania? I don't think he has.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was involved Dracula X or anything.
With Rondo Blood all the way back, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. He might have been maybe more of a junior guy, and then, you know, maybe with Symphony of the Night, he really stepped up, kind of like a Anuma with Majora's Mask, you know, like he ascended to the leader of that project and put his
control.
Own stamp on it. So I don't know for sure.
But it's a little bit out of his wheelhouse, but I mean, you could pretty much bet it's going to be, I would just say right now, it's going to be 5 levels long, pretty much about as long as the original Castlevania on the NES. That's that. If you follow the blueprint from the other two games, that's pretty much what it's going to be. And the next, we've got one last sort of WiiWare revival that came out as Bonk, which is actually coming not only to WiiWare, but to PSN and Xbox Live as well, which is kind of weird for Hudson. A lot of Hudson stuff has been WiiWare exclusive.
Yeah,
but I mean, Bonk is the one that I think most of us have said all along is, like, if they're going to keep remaking all these old Hudson games, why aren't they doing Bonk? It's the most iconic, other than Bomberman, but Bomberman's always around. You know?
Yeah, he's kind of ubiquitous. Definitely.
Bonk, they haven't made a Bonk game in a long time. And
there's a GameCube one or whatever it was.
Well, that's a remake of the...
remake, and it only came out in Japan.
Right, I have the import of that, and it's very good. I'm not sure if Hudson themselves made it. I'm not really sure who was involved with that, but it's very good, and that was my first time ever playing a Bonk game. I was like, hey, this is fun. Like, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, see,
but
I've never actually played a Bonk game.
Even that's like 5 years old.
I was kind of hoping that, was it Bonk's Revenge would win the retroactive poll to play that, which I voted for, but as we all know, it didn't.
It'll be in the second chance.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. So this is, it's polygonal graphics, and I assume it will be in HD on the HD consoles, although how much it'll make use of that, I don't know. But it's completely traditional sort of gameplay, although apparently it's going to have co-op and online functionality and all this sort of stuff, so definitely seems like maybe the reason why we haven't seen it before is they're putting a little more effort into it, maybe, and that's
why
it's appearing on the other platforms as well.
Yeah, I mean, Hudson has done so many WiiWare games.
And I know.
A lot of them are really interesting concepts, but it just seems like they're just throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks.
Well,
like,
yeah, I mean, they've really run the gamut as well. I mean, there's loads of revival stuff like Alien Crush and New Adventure Island or whatever. I mean, there's
New
loads
Adventure
of that.
Island.
But then there's, at the same time, you've got Water Warfares and the Onslaughts and all this. They are all over the map with WiiWare, aren't they?
Yeah, they also just announced the DSiWare Bomberman game as well, Bomberman Blitz.
Yeah, no, well, I guess that was only a matter of time.
Exactly.
Has to be everywhere.
All right, well, the next revival thing is the Project Needle Mouse.
Oh, my God.
Sonic. HD thing that was just this profoundly oblique trailer of, like, there was not even a logo, actually, but the silhouette of a logo.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's a 2D Sonic game, and
yeah,
it'll
that's
probably
what
be
we know.
Multi-platform, But it is a like strictly 2D Sonic game, and I'm not going to allow myself to be excited about this, but I am very, very curious to see how
it's more intriguing than exciting for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, they haven't done this before, and they say, well, you know, the weak rationalization with the game would be too short. But now they are going to do it, and you know, even though Sonic I think has done pretty well on Wii in terms of the Unleashed and like the other two games that were Wii exclusive has done okay, this is going to have HD graphics, so at best it's going to be multi-platform. Maybe it won't be on Wii at all.
I think it will be,
but the I presume downscaled. But it's just intriguing to me that you say you're not going to do the 2D for, and now apparently you're going to like throw everything at it. You know, that is a total U-turn.
What worked before? Nothing. So, they almost had to do a U-turn.
Yeah, I know. But before, they were saying they were going to have to work up to the U-turn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is pretty much the last frontier in terms of how they can butcher the franchise, so... they've screwed up everything but a 2D version, so why not?
Everybody always says the 2D games work well. Well, we'll see. How amazing would it be if they effed this up too?
It wouldn't be that amazing. It really would not be that.
It wouldn't be that surprising. But I think it is a chance for them to make good. I don't know that they'll take it, but it is a chance.
Because I think the problem with the stuff like the Werehog and all that is it's just conceptually faulty. You know, you just can't do it that well because it is
it's a dumb idea.
Yeah, it's just a terrible idea, and it's designed to pad a game. It's designed strictly to make it longer than it really is, essentially, than the content that's in it. Whereas with this, so you're not going to have something that's just conceptually absolutely wrong, but you can still design a poor game. And it's not so easy as just we've made these before, or other people have made them before, depending on who actually develops it. Let's just do that again. It's never that simple if you're going to do it right. It's much more subtle and challenging. So and to be fair, if you were just going to go back to the first one, I don't think it holds up that well. I mean, there's got to be some sort of progression there.
Well, to me, this is like a guy on death row that finds God. It's like, it doesn't matter. He's still a killer. So,
John is bringing the pain.
What he's saying is, this is not redemption.
It's not redemption. No matter what they do, it's not enough.
John's just like, out for blood here, man.
Old Testament, man. John's right.
John, just wait until the needle mouse puts his hand on your crotch and cures your kidney stones.
It's a green mile.
Yeah. Then you'll be a believer.
I'll believe it when I see it, I guess.
All right, well, the next thing we've got is some Tatsunoko vs. Capcom news. I haven't really talked all that much about this since E3, I suppose. But there's going to be... So it's basically like a new version of the game that's coming out in the West that's going to get re-released in Japan as well, which is kind of interesting because I don't think
it's like
sold.
USA version. They do this a lot with Final Fantasies and Kingdom Hearts and stuff.
It didn't sell gangbusters when it came out originally, but then it was like a really limited run, so I guess it never was going to. Kind of strange what happened with that in Japan originally, but there's going to be new characters on the Capcom side that includes Frank from Dead Rising and Zero from Mega Man X, and then on the other side it's like another Tekken Man. I played
Tekken
the game.
Man.
I don't know what the hell's going on. I've reviewed it. I don't know what the hell Tekken Man is. But the big thing is online play. They kind of skirted around it for a long time. It's definitely going to be in there, and all the versions will be able to play against each other, including the new Japanese version, apparently. So presumably, if you're getting your ass kicked on day one, it's probably to someone in Japan.
Yeah, this is exciting for me because this was a game that after I played at E3, I thought, man, I want this.
Yeah,
It was fun as hell, but who am I going to play it with? Like, none of my friends are going to play this. It's
That's the problem I've had.
So crazy.
I think you could convince anybody who really enjoys, fighting games to play that game.
But James, I mean, maybe I've alluded to this before, but I don't have that many gamer friends in real life. Like, people who are around me on a day-to-day basis, like, these people don't play games that much. Or if they do, it's a very specific kind of game that they might play with me every now and then. They might play a Rock Band with me every now and then.
No, I mean, this is pretty damn obscure niche stuff.
Right,
even
right.
I think gameplay-wise, it's not that unapproachable.
No,
at
all.
I didn't think
easy.
So at all. It's more approaching it, but yeah. I think the online play just it really makes it a lot easier for me to justify purchasing this. Cause
I mean, for me,
I
already
people.
Bought it on import. I mean, if the online play holds up and it's good, you know, we get the reports in, unlike certain other games, that it works, then I think I might even consider rebuying it at a reasonable price. You know, or having already paid the import, because I do really like it. It is a really good traditional fighting game. And online would probably let me, you know, get even more fun out of it than I've had before. So it's a big deal. It's just whether it's going to work very well. I mean, because I guess it's so. I mean, the commands are more complicated than Smash Brothers, well, not by much, but obviously all the crazy items and stuff isn't. So
yeah, I mean, Capcom has more experience with online play than Nintendo does.
Yeah, definitely.
It couldn't be worse.
No, but it could. Well. But I mean, you know, I haven't heard a whole lot of complaints about Street Fighter 4's online. Certainly, you know, Resident Evil 5 has good online play.
And also, was it? I think everyone seems to think Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD. I think everyone seems to think that's pretty good.
That's a different developer, but Capcom.
Yeah, no, it is. But I would assume they could sort of crib from that possibly, if need be, because that seems to hold up really well. But yeah, it's a really big inclusion, especially for the Western audience. You know, where online is so much of a bigger thing for getting games with anyone. All right, and then we're going to wrap up the news with this little bit that came out of the sort of aforementioned event about in Europe about WiiWare and DSiWare and stuff. That kind of goes back to when we were talking about the promoting the virtual console. We did the feature on it. There's going to be a new incentive scheme in Europe, so there's a patent on the one in Japan, but it's pretty interesting. First of all, if you manage to get refer one person to take their Wii online, you will both get 500 Wii points, which is, I suppose, a nice little bonus. Now, if you manage to get 10 people to credit you as getting them online, you get access to every single first-party NES title on the virtual console. And then if you manage somehow to get 20... that then extends to every single NES, Super NES, and Nintendo 64 game, including third-party titles, on the whole virtual console, which is insane. But
yeah, that seems very difficult to do.
Unless there's some sort of fraudulent activity. Yeah.
Either that, or you were advertising like a free connect your Wii to the internet service all over your town.
I think that's why they're okay with doing it. It's never going to be an issue.
Exactly. It's like one of these pyramid schemes where they say the person who earns 20,000 points gets a check for $1,000, but nobody ever actually does it.
Well, I guess
so.
What's interesting is, you know, with the DSi, they went with the thing of we'll package it with points. So you could go straight on buy something, although now you've got Flipnote Studio for free, which is probably going to be the thing that everyone will get straight away. You don't even need points for it.
They missed that boat with Wii, and part of it's because WiiWare didn't exist at the time. But, you know, they even, at one point, there was supposed to be a deal where if you bought a classic controller, you got like 1,000 points, and that ended up not happening. That would have been a really good idea.
There was a bundle in Japan with that, 5,000 Wii points and a classic controller in one package. That did happen.
That's 5,000. Wow.
But I don't think it was. I think it was an extra cost.
Yeah, but she paid for that 5,000.
But it was a saving overall.
Yeah.
But yeah, in general, they have not, especially in America, they still haven't done a lot of promotional stuff. But I guess the biggest thing would just be, say, for instance, like with the family members, like parents that might have a Wii, it might actually just entice you to take the time to say, well, actually, this goes online as well.
if they have Wi-Fi, if they don't, it's a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah, because then you got to get the LAN adapter out and all that kind of crap.
You have to find a LAN adapter.
Yeah, you can only buy it online. Yeah. But we have to clarify, this program's only for Europe so far. It hasn't been announced from the U.S. and or North America, I should say. But I mean, we've poo-pooed it a little bit in that just these crazy prizes.
Yeah, I mean, where are you going to find 20 people, honestly?
Yeah, very very few people are ever going to get that. That's more of an attention grabber. But you do get 500 points on both sides for connecting each person. So I could probably call up a couple of people and help them do this and pick up a 1,000 points. That would be awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that part would love to do that. And I mean, that's, and they've been doing that in Japan for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm glad this is kind of slowly creeping out, just like Club Nintendo. Japan, then Europe, then a year later, America.
Well, that's going to close it out for the roundup, pretty much. There's been so much downloadable stuff. I'm sure we've missed
a
number of things, including what John said about Bomberman. But I'm just glad we're getting so much downloadable stuff lately. What they do with like the summer, what was it, the summer of arcade and all that? Like the summer's very natural kind of time for it. But you see, it isn't letting up, and we're going to get a lot of stuff at the end of this year and the beginning of next.
Well, the thing with download is because it's not dependent on retail. It's more of a year-round phenomenon. I mean, if the games are being made year-round, it makes sense to release them year-round.
I guess it's just sometimes maybe you think maybe they might back off the peak retail time just for mindshare reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
But there's no, you know, they don't seem particularly concerned with that.
Seems like a good strategy. And so does taking a break right now, which we're going to do, and we'll be back with your listener mail. Try to collect some of your letters to the show and read them and talk about them, and this week is no different. The first letter comes from John, and it will be read by John.
John from Vermont writes, I was using the Wii Shop channel yesterday and started thinking about how much easier it would be to enter credit card info with a keyboard instead of the Wii remote. With consoles increasingly being used for paying for online transactions, browsing the internet, and emulating Commodore 64 games, a keyboard controller seems like a natural addition. Such a device would also make console MMOs a richer and more popular experience. Do you think a time will come when Nintendo will include some form of keyboard as a standard pack-in on their consoles? If so, how many generations are we away from that happening? It will never happen.
I think we're about 5 generations past that happening.
Yeah, packing, no way. I mean, you look at how they just try not to pack stuff in all the time. Like, you know,
there was a keyboard for Famicom in Japan. I mean,
yeah, but that was supposed to be like your household computer.
That was a weird hybrid product thing back then.
Right. It's for checking your bank account online in the 80s. But I mean, there are keyboards. You can plug in any USB keyboard into your Wii.
Yeah, USB keyboards. Does it work with the Wii Shop channel?
It does not work in the shop channel. It does work in the browser.
Yeah.
It works in certain games. I think Animal Crossing. You can use it in Animal Crossing and a couple other things. But, unfortunately, it does not work.
Although, what I will say to you straight away is it's a lot easier entering that kind of information with a Wii remote than it is with a PS3 pad.
Oh, yeah.
Amen to that, brother. Yes.
But the PS3 has, like, a weird little sort of keyboard thing that you could sort of put on top of the controller, right?
Oh, that thing,
you can buy some, but again, it's separate. I mean, that's the thing. It's always going to be the kind of thing they'll charge extra for, like the bloody Blu-ray remote or whatever, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's a Blu-ray player, but you better not want to actually control your movies. Now, there is a GameCube controller that had the keyboard.
Oh, God.
That thing was ridiculous.
The ASCII 2, yes.
Yeah, that's why I put this letter in
here. There was a keyboard with, like, on the two ends, it had the...
It was a GameCube controller stretched out with a keyboard in the middle.
Yes. That was the goofiest thing ever.
Well, I got to play with one of those at E3. They designed it for PSO.
Yes, Phantasy Star Online Episodes 1 and 2.
That's right, for GameCube. And you could use it with Phantasy Star Online Episode 3, the
card
game as
well.
Well,
how kind of them.
The thing is, if they packed that in with the GameCube, wouldn't that have increased the size of the box like threefold or something?
Yes, yeah. it was wider than the GameCube, yes.
It was considerably larger than the system itself. But, you know, the weird thing about that controller is that it wasn't nearly as big as I expected. I mean, it was probably wider than the original Xbox controller, the Duke, as people call it. But not...
Always bet on the Duke.
but not by much. I mean, it was maybe, I don't know, 6 or 8 inches wide. But look at a real keyboard. It's a lot wider than that.
Yeah.
So even my netbook keyboard that I'm looking at right now is easily 8 or 9 inches wide.
Yeah, I would say the keyboard was a little bit smaller than a netbook keyboard, but not that much smaller.
It was considerably smaller than my netbook. Huh. And I have the same model as you, James, more or less. So trust me, I mean, I played with this thing. I was shocked at how tiny the keys were. I was trying to demo the game and play with this ridiculous controller, and I'm trying to type stuff on it, and I'm having difficulty typing on it. Because the buttons are so small. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, what's the point?
Awesome. By the way, I think, first off, I should have brought one of those next time I go to some party where we're going to play Smash Brothers. Just show up with that.
Dude, that would be fucking awesome.
And don't forget, of course, in the future, you'll just be able to do it with like, invisible keyboards with Natal or whatever. So
you'll be able to type with your hands. Just form the letter A with your hands in a air.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the rollout keyboards?
Yes.
That you can get for certain things? Those are really cool.
There's also the keyboards that project the laser onto the table and you can see where your fingers hit.
Yeah, I bet they suck. But they're really cool. They remind me of that musical keyboard that Captain Picard had. Never mind. So, So Greg has the next letter.
Brood Wars writes, I thought I'd throw in my own overlooked gem from the GameCube era, Monolith's Baton Kaitos Origins. This is a quirky game that suffered both from being a Twilight era GameCube game and from being a sequel to an obscure RPG that not a whole lot of people bought and fewer liked. But many of the things people didn't like about the original Baton Kaitos were fixed with Origins. This is a game that's obvious Nintendo didn't know what to do with, as they basically ensured it had a fantastic localization and then threw it out to die in the marketplace with maybe a couple of ads in EGM. I think a lot of people miss this game and should definitely check it out if they are fans of RPGs and can appreciate or look past the quirky card aspect of the game.
I've always heard really good things about Baton Kaitos Origins. Mm-hmm. Definitely in comparison to the first one, which I played maybe a
disagree
couple minutes of the first
heavily,
one. But
okay.
So you don't...
I've actually talked about this game on the show, haven't I?
Well, certainly the series.
Yeah, I actually feel like the original is the superior title, and I'm in the minority in that. I feel like they oversimplified the battle system, but they're both good games. One thing they did in the second game is, in the first game, I think there were like 9 characters, and each character had a different set of cards as their attacks. So what would happen is you would find, I have a physical attack for these characters, but I don't have any for you in my hand. Which was fine, because there were certain conceits in how the game played that let you work around that most of the time. And you built your... I mean, obviously, if you had these 3 characters in your party, you didn't have other characters' attacks in your hands. But what they did in the sequel is they basically said, this is an attack card. Everyone uses the same cards. There are some other things they took out that were character-specific cards that I thought were cool and gave more strategy to it. But one thing they did do is the original game had like 7 or 8 characters. I can't remember right off how many. But the second game had 3 characters, and that is it. And it was a very tight story told around these 3 characters. Mm-hmm. And there was a very real relationship between each character and every other character. And it affected the story and how the characters progressed. And it was a much better localization than the original, where the original's voice acting for at least one character was so laughably bad.
Oh, it's all coming back to me now.
Yes, it was so bad in the original trailer they released that they recast his voice actor, and he wasn't any better. If you go watch the original released trailer, which is really just the opening cinematic to Baton Kaitos, the original game, the character Liyue, his voice acting is so terrible, and you won't need to know who he is. Because they talk and they say their name, but as soon as he starts talking, you will realize this is the guy I'm talking about. It's so bad, they replaced him in the game's release, and it's still bad. It's just unbelievable.
Kind of like Luke in Professor Layton.
Worse than Luke.
No, but I mean, there's a There's a
they replaced him in the European version. Right. Yes.
He is different in the European version. He doesn't sound particularly good, no.
No, but I mean, this is some just amazingly bad voice acting.
Now, of course, Monolith went on to get, they've been acquired by Nintendo.
Yes.
And they made Disaster. But I haven't heard, James, you haven't heard you mention what that Monado beginning of the world that came up
in
E3.
I think it looks really cool.
Yeah, I am interested in that game, but I'm not, really, haven't really sat down and read all
the
stuff.
Well, there's not a lot of stuff out there about it.
Yeah, but I mean, they're kind of a sieve over at Monolith, from my experience. So information gets out of them relatively easily compared to some other now Nintendo-owned subsidiaries.
I wonder if they'll have more about it, whatever. They always hold something around TGS, not at TGS.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. So I bet they will.
What I do think about Baten Kaito's Origins is it was overlooked. It was considerably shorter than its predecessor, at least in my experience, which in a way was good. But I didn't like the main character. I thought he looked ridiculous. I mean, the characters all look ridiculous, but he looked especially ridiculous. So it was always kind of funny when I looked at him, which it's kind of a shame because everything else is so well designed, but he's like bizarro looking. I can't even explain it, except for the fact that his hair is a color of blue that's so bright that it sticks out in the rest of the art design when he's walking around.
Well, before we move on, I do want to say that I love the poetry of this person who wrote in saying that it came out in the Twilight era of the GameCube, because if you think about it, the Twilight era of the GameCube was when Twilight Princess came out for GameCube.
It came out before that. I mean,
yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about the Twilight era of the GameCube is it was a bit too long.
It went on for a long time.
Yeah, indeed. And that happened for N64 as well.
Yeah, I don't think to the same extent, though. I think the GameCube was kind of worse.
I think maybe the GameCube was worse, but I think...
Well, it started so early.
It did, but I think the N64's highs and lows were so bad that it was like, well, what is the Twilight era? Is it when no games are coming out for you? Because right now it's one every 3 months. Mm-hmm. I think that if you enjoyed the first game, you definitely need to try to find a copy of this game because it is still beautiful. It still has amazing music. It still has a very solid story. And it does try to touch more on more mature themes than just, hey, let's go save the world in the previous title.
All right. Well, James, you have the next letter.
All right. So Adolf Vega from Denton, Texas writes, as I was playing Metroid Prime Trilogy the other day, the graphics engine still impresses me years later. The art direction is just so fantastic. The cracks in the floor as you walk around, the game is overall dripping in atmosphere. It seems more and more that games don't care about graphic art direction and just try to push high polygon graphics. Seems like 2D games push it more to get positive buzz, like Boy and His Blob, but 3D games just don't really try to have the unique art direction. What do you guys think about art direction in games?
This argument's been going on for a while, really. It's nothing new, but I think it's still relevant.
I guess the first thing I want to say about this is that a lot of games have not got comparable art direction to Metroid Prime, whether they're HD or not HD or 3D or not.
I would agree with that.
It stands up against anything. I don't think that other games fall short of Metroid Prime is a commentary about the industry in general. It's just about how good that game is and how good retro are in that regard.
But yeah, I mean, if you think about a lot of complaints that people have about some of the more, like the Unreal Engine type games for Xbox 360 and PS3, there a lot of that boils down to art direction in that, a lot of these companies, they're not putting that much effort into making these games look different from each other. And I think part of the reason for that, it's not really a new problem. There were plenty of 2D games back in the 16-bit era that looked very cookie-cutter.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and they kind of chased trends, didn't they? Because Donkey Kong Country came along, everything had to be pre-rendered because that was, the thing.
Right.
Yep.
So I think what happens is that to do the kind of art direction that you see in Metroid Prime, or even to approach that, you're probably not going to be as good as that. But even to approach it is so expensive. Mm-hmm. Because, I guarantee that Retro Studios employs more artists than just about any other, let's say as a proportion of the total number of employees, than just about any other developer. Because, art is what they do. It is a huge component of the games that they make. And a lot of other companies, you know, they have some concept artists who kind of give some vague ideas about what this world is going to look like or what the characters will look like. And then they have a couple of animators.
Well, I suppose the other thing is the sort of economics of it on the HD platforms is that that might be a bit more of a luxury in the sense that, you know, everything else is so much more of an expensive to do that right. You have to concentrate your resources in those areas rather than the art side. Perhaps that has a role right. to play, but it's not as if you don't get very sort of artistically sort of flourishing games on those formats in general. Prince of Persia. And
yeah, I would say that all the Prince of Persia games have solid art direction.
Well, actually, I think Ubisoft overall is head and shoulders above almost any other big publisher in terms of the consistency and the quality of their art design. And, you know, Ubisoft makes a number of games that I don't want to play that may not be good at all. But I think, generally speaking, and maybe it's a French mentality or, you know, a Quebecois kind of thing, but I think they care more about art direction than other publishers, and that feeds into all their internal studios, at least.
I know EA gets accused of this a lot, but
Dead Space has some nice art direction.
I was actually thinking of
Mirror's Edge?
Yeah, Mirror's Edge. Mm-hmm. Mirror's Edge has some very fantastic detail and art direction.
I don't know about detail. It's all kind of the opposite of detail.
It's very stylish.
But, I mean, there are elements of the cityscape that normally get ignored in a game.
Yeah.
And that in itself is a form of detail.
Yeah, I mean, the cool thing about art direction is that when it's really good, people notice and people talk about it. So I feel like, you know, developers are rewarded at least critically for having good art direction. But what you see is that it doesn't really translate into sales. And unfortunately, this is a mass market industry at this point, and the average person doesn't care as much about art as they do about, you know, a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
So it ends up being, it's hard to justify spending a lot of money on it.
Yeah, in the end, it's not the most important thing.
Well, and moreover than that, I mean, let's just say Modern Warfare 2. It almost doesn't matter whether or not it has good art direction. It's going to have very sharp-looking graphics. It's going to be very eye-popping in terms of the sharpness of the models and the explosion effects and stuff like that. And the audience that's most interested in that game, that, you know, they're probably not playing it for the graphics specifically, but they're going to care more about that than they would about really nice art direction.
Well, I think also to a certain degree, I think people don't generally appreciate art direction if it's geared towards realism. They just don't like it. You know, like it doesn't stand out to them. They don't think – it's like if you're just trying to make something look realistic, you're not being artistic with it, and I don't necessarily agree with that. Like, in other words, there's no art to Modern Warfare 2 because they're just trying to make it look like a picture, like an actual photograph, right? So there's no art to that, but I don't really agree with that. I mean,
Well, how much of that, though, comes down to the idea that at sort of the uncanny valley, where things are more realistically detailed, they don't look real?
I mean, I haven't played any of the Unreal games, the Unreal Engine games, to know, but is it some of the problem that you've got, like, very, very realistic in many regards, but then you've got these bizarre, disproportionate character models?
Yeah,
The incongruity of that might...
The reason that a lot of Unreal Engine games look the same is because they a lot of them use assets out of a common library, and, you know, they tend to be different kinds of dirty surfaces and broken
grays
glass
and
shit like that. Yeah, and you know, and then you look at something like Gears of War 2, it actually does a lot of things that are more colorful, more interesting, but that's because those guys make that engine. They're not going to use the stock assets. They're going to make their own. They pay artists to do that. And, you know, there's art in that game that I think is ghastly, but they made it that way because they like it. So
yeah. Now, one game that usually gets a lot of flack for not being original but actually has amazing art direction is Killzone 2. The environments in that game are some of the best I've ever seen, and they're incredibly detailed. Now, you may not like the world that it's in. You might think, whatever, it's gray, brown, everything. But the environments are absolutely amazing in that game. That whole game has amazing art direction.
I wouldn't have thought of that game, but I haven't played it.
It's amazing.
It's interesting.
And now, granted, everything is very kind of post-apocalyptic and rusted out, but I mean...
Yeah. I mean, that makes me think of, like, Half-Life 2. I've been trying to finish up the episode 2. I'm really close to the end, by the way. But I'm just playing it in little tiny spurts. But, like, I look around that game, and I'm starting to maybe gain some appreciation for why people revere it the way they do, because the art direction is very good. The world they've created is very believable and consistent. And you look at things and it makes you kind of wonder what happened here, what went wrong, why is this building all busted out and abandoned? Yeah.
Do I really want to go in here? This building's all fucked up.
Right, and that actually, you hit upon it exactly, James. It's that, like, I appreciate the work that went into designing this world and making it look the way it does, but I don't like the way it looks. It's not a place that I want to hang out. And that is good art direction. When you have a visceral reaction to that, it means that they're doing something right. I just, you know, it's the artistic choices that they're making. Maybe I don't agree with them in some cases, or it doesn't work for me.
Some of it's just in the eye of the beholder too. I mean, what sure. you consider art direction. And I would
Absolutely.
Say that the reason, since we talked about 3D games, but he mentions 2D games in there. The reason some 2D games made now, generally speaking, have good art direction is because if they didn't, we'd kill them. Because
there's no excuse.
I mean...
Exactly. So that's why we get things like Aboyna's Blob and Muramasa and Wario Land Shake It. And they all look amazing. It's because they kind of have to, because they're 2D.
Yeah.
If they look like shit, we would just crucify them.
But New Super Mario Bros. Wii does not. It doesn't have to. And it certainly doesn't have to sell what it's going to sell.
It's going
to
sell a million copies.
It's just reproducing the same look that they've had for the sort of Mario universe for ages, and obviously from the DS game. So with that one, it's not like they felt under pressure to do anything special with it at all.
No, I think other than Galaxy, and maybe World a little bit, but in general, I don't really feel like Mario is a franchise where they've spent a lot of time on art direction.
Nah,
there's some in Super Mario World. I think there's more in Galaxy.
Definitely
in
Galaxy.
But really, Yoshi's Island is the one where they went crazy.
Yeah, you're right.
And Yoshi's Story, the art direction is probably the best thing about that game, the sort of weird construction of the world. But in the mainline stuff, they tend to be pretty conservative, because again, that's just, you know, I think because they don't feel like they have to do anything other than that usually.
Right. It's kind of weird knowing that Miyamoto was a cartoonist, you know, an illustrator, and when he's got his start. Okay. Well, the final question is from Must Be Bert from Rochester, New York, and he writes, "I'm aware of the new Aragorn game for the Wii that is scheduled for the fall. I'd like to hear your thoughts on any details you've heard concerning that game. Also, with the Hobbit film currently in the works, have any of you heard rumors about a possible Hobbit game for the Wii? I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, and I was hoping for some kind of game to be released that would be similar to what EA did on the GameCube. I always imagined the Wii controls to be a lot of fun in some sort of action game with a Lord of the Rings theme." Well, the Aragorn game, I played it at E3, and actually, let me go back a little bit. There was a Hobbit game for GameCube. And it was released around the time of the movies, even though obviously it wasn't based on any of those movies. It was from a different company. They happened to own the rights to the Hobbit book, and they were trying to get in on the popularity of the whole Lord of the Rings thing at the time, which was a smart move. And that game's actually pretty good. It's really interesting. And I have a review on the site, and it might be worth your while to go track it down. I'm sure you can get it for really cheap now. The reason that I bring that up is that the Aragorn game for Wii actually reminds me a lot more of that Hobbit game than it does of the Lord of the Rings stuff that EA did last generation. Because it is more aimed at children, unabashedly. It is simple. The combat is quite simple. It's about traveling across great distances. You are playing specifically as Aragorn the entire game. So you have these other companions who hang out with you and they help you in battle and stuff, but you're controlling Aragorn specifically always. And it's probably a little too simple for most older gamers, I would think. But it's charming. It's well done. It's a little bit cartoonish. It is a lot like the Hobbit game was. So not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a far cry from the Lord of the Rings stuff that EA did back on PS2, Xbox, and GameCube, which was pretty dark, violent stuff. I mean, those were movie licensed games.
Yeah.
They looked like the movies, and they had that tone. And you know, you're just killing hundreds of orcs, and
yes,
I enjoyed those games really
they were great.
Very scripted, very high action. There's really no downtime in those games. Like, it's fight. There's a little bit of strategy. There's a little bit of God of War kind of stuff, you know, some of the early design stuff like that. But I don't think they would be fun with Wii controls. Like,
no, you'd be exhausted.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, those very games repetitive. Are so, so heavy on combat. It's like, you know, kill 300 enemies in this battle.
Yeah, you'd have to design something pretty different around the Wii Remote if he's going to do it right. Maybe Motion Plus now, possibly.
It's an interesting thought.
The Aragorn game's been done by the Headstrong people, the former Kuju.
So yeah.
Overkill, so most recently, they would have done.
Yeah, they did Overkill, and they did, you know, Geometry Wars Galaxies and Battalion Wars 1 and 2. They're all over the place. So, I mean, I feel like it will be a high-quality game. I feel like it'll be well done.
Like, what were your impressions of it when you played it?
It's just, it is made for kids. It is a kids' game. They were very upfront about that.
Yeah, I mean, the presentation is very, isn't it like Sam telling the Hobbit children about Aragorn's adventures or something?
Yeah,
it's like very
that's cool.
Explicitly.
Yeah, I like that part. But the gameplay of it is really more where I was like, oh, okay, this is probably not for me. Because it's very simple. It holds your hand a lot. It tells you exactly where to go. It has a neat little kind of co-star kind of mode where a second player can join in and they'll play as Gandalf and, you know, shoot magic around the screen and stuff like that. But it's very, you wouldn't really need the help. I mean, it's not hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's very simple. So it's not, I don't think it'll be a bad game, but it's not going to make my my best of the year list either.
And I don't really see a game based on The Hobbit, you know, however the movie turns out, being that much like those Lord of the Rings games that were the official movie tie-ins. Because The Hobbit...
Yeah. I mean, the story is much different.
I mean, indeed, The Hobbit, as a story, is far more aimed at children originally.
Yeah,
and presumably the film's...
It is. Far more like a fairy tale.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I could see a Hobbit game having quite a lot of different gameplay styles because the story's all over the place. Like, it's completely different from chapter to chapter.
There's two or three real fights in that game. In that story, sorry.
Right, and the GameCube game had some more platforming stuff, and it also had quite a bit of stealth, which made sense. You know, he had the,
Yo, of
he
course,
had the ring,
yeah.
And he couldn't keep it on for really long, because it would, you know, it would hurt him or bother him. So it was kind of time-limited. You had to think about when you put on the ring and what was the right way to do it. And there was a lot of sneaking around, which was more of Bilbo's style, rather than go in and...
Yeah.
The GameCube game is really well done. It's worth checking out if you're a big fan of The Hobbit, and I think that would be a very good template for any developer who's going to be making something based on the new movie. All right, that's going to end listener mail. Of course, if you want to get your letter read on the air, you can send it to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we do read all the letters we get. We don't have time to talk about all of them on the show, but we definitely appreciate getting them. And next week, don't forget, we're talking about Geist with Retroactive, and we're going to have the really cool opportunity of having the Nintendo of America producer on the show, Jeff Callis. So pick up the game. And if you have any thoughts on it or any questions, jump in the forums and drop them in there. And if you get in there on time, we'll try to read them out to Jeff and get his reactions or get his answers to your questions. It's going to be really exciting. So that's next week. We're back and we're out. Let me just say that I think during my 30 days of free shipping with Amazon Prime, I think I spent $700 or $800 at Amazon.
Oh my god!
Well, I mean that's including the PS3 and the fucking Guitar Hero and Rock Band
Cog
stuff
in the system.
Oh man,
it was a lot of. It was closer to $600.
But all the stuff that was the most expensive to ship, so at least you kind of hosed them.
I don't actually have a job.
He went and bought lead weights from Amazon. 2 days ship this, bitch.
Yeah, I mean...
antique diver's outfit.
You're paying Amazon like $70 a year so that you can spend an insane amount of money at Amazon.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, it's just crazy.
I mean, there was a time last year when I was really going hardcore. I was probably buying 5 or 6 games a month.
Yeah, I'm buying 3, and that's me restraining myself.
Yeah.
I mean, if I didn't, God knows, I'd be buying 6. It's funny because I was kind
addicted,
I was kind of down on gaming, you know, back in May-ish. You know,
well,
I still
playing
played
got
some...
to do with it. It's the acquisition addiction.
It's
Pokemon. I mean, it's like, are you really going to put this Pokemon in your team? No, but you've got to have it.
I
see, for me, it's playing. it's the time that it kills me when I buy a lot of games, because I will actually play all of them.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I do. I mean, my God, I played Chromehound.
Yeah,
and that was and that was a fucking disaster. I played through all the different training agendas for that game because, goddammit, I was going to get some value out of this game.
You didn't, though. You just immiserated yourself. You got negative value. It's just worse. Cut your losses, Jake.
There would be very few bands you could apply some of the lessons that you've learned to here. No, it's a Guitar Hero game, but obviously you can't apply some of the lessons to Guitar Hero Van Halen. I mean, unless there's like a chest hair option in Beatles Rock Band, there's nothing really relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I do think playing Beatles Rock Band makes you realize that Van Halen is not going to work all that well. But I mean, you just have to understand, Van Halen doesn't have the cultural relevancy of the Beatles. They weren't nearly as influential as the Beatles.
Really?
They weren't. Well, and the other thing is, they weren't as artistic as the Beatles. So you don't have this flowing imagery.
I think Michael Bay isn't as artistic as Stanley Kubrick. I'd just like to point that out for everyone as well.
Michael Bay hero. How many explosions can you squeeze on the screen at one time?